Well, good morning, everybody. How many are here today who were not here last night? If you just give me a show of hands, okay? What I'd like to do to begin, if you don't mind, is to take you on a little meditation. We will be doing a piece of work this morning, what I call writing your first step. Now, you don't have to write it all this morning, but I at least want to take you through a model of the way I think it can be done in terms of codependency. So I'll be asking you to reflect a lot on your own life and your own life experience, a lot of private kind of work this morning. This afternoon we may do a little more sharing. But if you would just get real comfortable for right now, remember when you meditate to be comfortable. First time I learned meditation, I meditated on my nose itching. For the entire time. So if your nose itches, scratch it. And just be as comfortable as you can. And I recommend that you close your eyes. If you don't feel comfortable with that, don't do that. Or you can close them and peek occasionally. So if you just close your eyes right now, and just for a couple of minutes, focus on your breathing. Just allow your mind to become full of breathing so that you're mindful of breathing. This basic life function that we do unconsciously most of the time. Just be aware of what happens in your chest, what happens in your body when you breathe. And if you like, you can be aware of the air as it comes in, what it feels like when it comes in, and the air as it goes out. Be aware of the difference, the contrast, as you breathe in and as you breathe out. As you focus on your breathing, just for now, there's no place you have to go. There's nothing you have to do. There's no face that you have to prepare to meet the faces. You can just be here now. Just be here now. Be here now. Feel the pew on your back and your feet on the ground. Feel your hands touching your body or wherever they are. Hear the sounds, whatever sounds you can hear. feel your clothes on your body. Feel the air as it touches your face. And just be in touch with yourself in the here and now. Just in touch with yourself. As you breathe in and out, if you could begin to see like a white number 7 on a black curtain, or a black number 7 on a white curtain. And it's okay if you don't see it. You can just imagine yourself finger painting it. Or you can hear it in your mind's ear, 7, as you breathe out. Or you can do all three of those. Just focusing your attention now so you can get to that inner stillness, inner quiet. And then the number 6, seeing the number 6, or finger painting it, or hearing it as you breathe out. That mental image that you learned to make long ago when you were children. When you were children in school. The teacher put the numbers on the board. You had to make a mental image of every number. And you had to compare that mental image with every other number. You had to compare a 6 with a 5 and a 6 with a 4. And a 6 with a 3 and a 6 with a 2 and a 6 with a 1. And a 1 with a 2, and a 1 with a 3, and a 1 with a 4, and a 1 with a 1, and a 2 with a 1, and a 3 with a 1. And now you do all of that unconsciously. You never think about it. So your unconscious really knows so much more than your conscious mind. You can really trust your unconscious. You can trust your unconscious throughout this day to allow you to focus on the things you need to know for you, the things that are important for you, and not compare yourself with anyone else, because you're incomparable. And what's important for you may not be important for someone else. And there's no right or wrong in this work. It's what's important for you. And now see the number 5. Just allow yourself to relax. Just to go into this inner peace. In the number 4. Number 4. In the number 3. Just allowing yourself to go to the place that's most appropriate for you. To take you into your own relaxation, your own inner calm and inner peace. And then the number 2. And the number 1. And now as you focus on the number 1, just begin to see it become a candle. So you're looking into the flame of that candle, that quiet, powerful energy of fire. The blue, orange, yellow, reddish flame. Just gaze into the center of that and let the center of that flame, the power that comes from its burning with the stillness, just let that take you to your own center your own sense of integration. And that you can trust yourself. You can trust that what you focus on today will be what's important for you. And you can trust that even though you may not grasp it all or be able to retain it all, you'll retain what's important to you. And you can really trust this deep, profound sense of yourself. And now, for a minute of clock time, which is all the time in the world to the unconscious, just let your whole self integrate. Just let your whole self be in a dream of integration. Just for 1 minute of clock time. And do that now. Take that symbol of integration, whatever it is, the feeling or the words or the images or the colors that came to you, and just trust that your unconscious really knows. That you've forgotten all the new learnings in your life, all the times you did things you didn't know you could do, all the beginnings that were frightening to you that you got through and surprised yourself with. That you can really trust yourself. And that you have hope for yourself, or you wouldn't be here. And you have courage, and you're willing to risk. And you can love yourself and embrace yourself. And just staying in that center, and you can count on it, that this calm will stay with you all day. That you can trust this centeredness all day long. And now in your mind's eye or in your mind's ear, begin to see the candle flame turning into a one. The number one. And then the number two. And then the number three. And ever so slowly now, you're slowly coming back to your normal waking consciousness. The number four, knowing that you can retain this kind of inner centeredness and peace. And the number five. And the number six. And now very slowly with the number seven. As you see or finger paint it, just slowly, very slowly now, open your eyes and be fully present in this beautiful place, sound in mind and sound in body. One of the ways to describe codependency is to say that it's exactly the opposite of what we just did. That it's to have no inner life. And that our life is characterized by a relinquishment to the outside. And last night I talked about dysfunctional families and how that happens to anyone in a dysfunctional family. Because every dysfunctional family, whether it's an alcoholic or chemical family, whether it's a rageaholic family, whether mother is hysterical and worries all the time and hyperventilates and drives everybody crazy, or whether mother's a hypochondriac and so you have to walk on eggs all the time, or daddy's a work addict and mama's his enabler, and there's tension in their relationship and you always are reacting and responding to that tension, or whether there's religious addiction in the family and you're always being measured by biblical verses or so that you can never have your feelings or be real. Whatever the dysfunction is, you're going to have to adapt to something on the outside. I can remember as a kid being two blocks from my house and saying to myself, well, I wonder what's going on in there. Is Daddy home? If he's home, is he drinking? If he's drinking, what kind of shape is he in? If he isn't home, what kind of shape is Mother in? Is she going to be raging? Could I bring a friend home? No. See, my whole life was an adaptation to the stress. And so I suggested to you last night, if you're a child of any dysfunctional family, violent families, sexually abusing families, a little girl who's being sexually abused doesn't ever want to go home. One of my clients told me she would stay outside as long as she could. Her brother was abusing her. Her life was one total misery. She wanted to die. She couldn't understand how anybody would ever want to live. Why anybody had any joy out of life. Why anybody was interested in things. Because her life was like being hunted. And so, violence. You never know whether daddy's going to knock mother across the room or knock one of you across the room. One day you can do something and he's okay. The next day you do the same thing and he goes crazy. Or mama goes crazy. Do you see the stressor? And that a child is continually adapting, but the danger's on the outside. So my best definition of codependency is what I took from Artigi Gasset, the Spanish existentialist philosopher, where he characterizes human life as within oneselfness, in sinmismamiento, the Spanish word, within oneselfness, to have an inner self, an inner relationship with self. That's an identity. As opposed to alteration, he says, otheration. Other, the word O-T-H-E-R hyphen ation, A-T-I-O-N. That is that my life is totally relinquished to the outside, like an animal. Like an animal. Animals live totally on guard, looking for food, protecting their territory. They are other-aided, as opposed to healthy humans that are hopefully have a life within themselves. Codependency is otheration. Your whole life is determined by what's outside of you. Now, there are degrees of this. If you come from an alcoholic, violent, sexually abusing family, you're going to be far more damaged than somebody who may be from an alcoholic family where dad isn't a violent drunk, but it's just a stressor. If you come from a religiously addicted family or a workaholic family, that'll even be more crazy-making. Because how do you, you know, here's this good, holy mother. Or here's this father who's an elder in the communities, an elder in the church. He's on the mayor's council. He makes thousands, millions of dollars. Or, boy, that's real crazy-making. And see, there's myths about families. Part of the delusion and denial is the myth. The myth. Every time I used to get upset about my grandfather for some reason, who was the only father figure I had, they would say, well, your grandfather prayed the rosary when Stalin died. So I'd go to my room, you know, man. How can you get mad at somebody who prayed the rosary when Stalin died? And if I'd asked my mother about my dad, she said, well, everybody, your father's popular. Everybody in West Texas knows your dad. except me. You know, everybody in town knew my dad except me. So you see, those are the myths that you're told to distract you from what's really happening. And that's called delusion and denial. And dysfunctional families are dominated by delusion and denial. Oh, I had a happy childhood. And listen, when I'm through today, some of you will get to a lot of feelings. You may get into a lot of pain. You'll go out of here, and by tomorrow you'll be saying, well, Bradshaw, you know, of course he had that screwed up family. Mine wasn't that bad. Because basically, what you have to do to leave these family systems is go through a grief process. Anybody that's going to grow up has got to leave home. And when you leave anything, you grieve. And I guarantee you, the first thing you will experience as you really begin to look at the way your family really was is shock, which is what everybody experiences in grief. You go, oh no, Harold didn't die, you're kidding. Oh no, my family really wasn't like that. As I shared last night about my own emotional incest and the issues of being set up as my mother's surrogate spouse as part of the family system. See, if a family doesn't have a daddy, a family's like a mobile. It tries to balance itself, so it needs somebody to be the husband. If there's no daddy there, one of the boys in the family will become the emotional husband. If daddy isn't making it with mama, and they're staying together in their relationship, but there's this big intimacy vacuum, nature abhors a vacuum, so daddy will pick up one of the daughters to be his little princess, or to be his emotional confidant. And then the daughter will be used by the father for his emotional needs. How do you like to be used in a relationship, folks? But when you're a kid, you can't get that you're being used. That's what we call the setup. See, I was proud that I was my mother's favorite. My grandfather would call me 4 times a week. Are you taking care of your poor mother? 9 years old. Yes, sir, I'm taking care of her. We were all taking care of her. And my mother's, you know, my mother's okay. My mother's a victim, too. I'm not putting her down for this, but you got to find out what really happened. How did this leg get crippled? How come it is that I'm 45 years old and I've still got all these problems? And I still have relationship problems. And I've been through bunches of relationships, and I don't know what I feel, and I don't know how to express my feelings. And as soon as all the activity stops, I feel suicidal or depressed and lonely. Where does all that come from? It doesn't happen in healthy, warm, vibrant families when people are getting their needs met. So we've got to begin to look at what happened to us so we can deal with it in ourselves. The second level of grieving is denial. Shock, oh no, denial, then bargaining. Well, my family really wasn't that bad. Bargaining, 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 bargaining. Then anger. And then you start getting below the anger. See, because below the anger is the hurt and the pain. And I said last night, I quoted Carl Jung, who said, neurosis is always a substitute for legitimate suffering. What we don't want to get to is that hurt and that pain. For me to really accept that I didn't have a father, that my father didn't love me. They said, well, your daddy really does love you. They constantly told me my daddy really loved me. See, Scott Peck defines love as the will to extend yourself for the sake of nurturing your own and another's spiritual growth. On that definition, my daddy didn't love me. Now, my daddy was surrogate spoused with his mother. He had been abandoned by his own father. I never saw my grandfather once in my life. So I'm not blaming my dad. This is not a blame game. This is a responsibility game. Try to find out what really happened to us and break through all this family system delusion and denial and all this mythology. For all my life, my dad's family was screwed up. My dad was the alcoholic. And my dad, my brother and I'd get drunk and we'd say we're going to go beat up dad or we were going to go get dad. And always it was mother we were taking care of and her family was perfect. My grandfather prayed the rosary when Stalin died. My grandmother was in bed for 50 years, but of course she was sick. And then it dawned on me at 45 that three of her daughters were alcoholic and three had married alcoholics. Perfect family. Went to St. Vincent de Paul Church. I compared every family to them. They were probably sicker than my dad's family. But it's crazy making. It's much harder to get. Because they were all in roles all the time. They never showed any real feelings. It was always a pretend and be a nice woman and always guard your feelings. And this afternoon we're going to get into those roles, those family system roles. And the pretend and the act. That soul murders you. You lose your soul when you go into those acts. You're no longer you. And after 20 years of it, you don't even know who you are. You think you're the act. You can pass lie detectors. They say, is this who you are? Yes, sir, that's who I am. I had a therapist one time tell me, God, you must be lonely. I thought it was the craziest thing I'd ever heard. I went out of there vowing never to go back to him. I fired several therapists in my life. Anytime they told me things I didn't like. But it haunted me. I kept thinking about it and thinking about it. And I realized that I was so into my act. I was so distracted all the time. I had energy and activity and work and stuff going all the time. I never had any time to know what I felt. See, and sometimes you've got to get to these quiet places. And you've got to go in there and get quiet so that you can know and catch up with yourself. So that you can know what you really feel. See, sometimes you gotta feel as bad as you really feel if you're ever gonna get well. You gotta feel as bad as you really feel. And if you stay distracted and all your stuff are obsessed on your alcoholic boyfriend, you're in your head sleuthing around trying to save him or trying to save your husband, trying to save your children. You're in your head all the time obsessing. Ruminating, you don't ever have time to know what you feel. So a lot of times if we get a woman in treatment whose husband's an alcoholic or a man in treatment whose wife's an alcoholic, we try to keep, you know, and like the questions last night, how do I fix my husband? How do I fix my... See, that's codependency. It's like, what I got to do is get in touch with me. If my mama could have ever been helped... If somebody could have said, Norma, wait a minute, what do you feel? Now tell me what you feel. And let her get how lonely she was. How terrible this non-intimate marriage was. And quit focusing on us or my daddy's drinking. Then you see what feelings do is they move you. You don't know what you feel, you don't have your energy, your fuel. And so why do we talk so much about getting into your feelings? Because it's precisely in these systems that are dysfunctional that you have to give up your feelings. You can no longer have your feelings. You have to adapt to survive. We'll really be working on that this afternoon, whatever role you got in. Like I was a hero in my family system. What feelings do you have to give up to be a hero? What feelings can't you have if you're going to be a hero? See, heroes can't wimp around and be afraid. So one of the ways I've broken out of that is when my family, somebody in my family calls me, which they rarely do now, they say, well, how's it going? I say, well, not bad for an emotionally disturbed person. I'm not going to be the hero anymore. And because, you know, all my life I tried to take care of my little brother. And I was my dad's dad in AA. I brought my dad into AA. They used to call me a block off the old chip. And all my life I've been taking care of people. I went to be a priest so I could take care of the world. You know, it's like I got to stop doing that if I want to live and have my own reality. So you've got to go to this inner place. And the grief process is a hard process. We're not telling anyone that you have to leave your family or not have a relationship with your mom and dad. But you've got to get out of that family. And the way you do that is you grieve it. Because if you stay in the family, you go right back into the codependency. You go back into the roles that keep the thing together. See, dysfunctional families are characterized by frozenness and rigidity. Nobody can leave. If your family's dysfunctional and they're having the big get-together at Christmas and you say, well, look, I've got all these friends in Santa Fe and we have this wonderful community there and we network and we go up in the mountains and we meditate and we're all going to celebrate and we're going to all come together to create a consciousness threshold for world peace. And I'm really excited about it. You'll hear a silence on the other end of the line. And they say, well, okay. You know, your father's getting old and he may not be around for very long. And I, too, was, you know, I have high blood pressure now. And I may not be around next year. And so the classic feeling, if you're from a dysfunctional family, is guilt. See, that's the thin veneer. Terry Kellogg says this is the thin veneer of codependency, is guilt. What it means is you do not have a right to be a unique person. I went to Rice University. I went there for 4 years. After 2 master's degrees, I got first-class honors in all the courses. I learned French and German, passed oral and written comprehensive. I taught the psychology of religion for 2 years and never got a doctorate. It took me 15 years to get what that was all about. And what it was about is my family system. That you can't be that powerful. You can't be a doctor coming out of my system. That's too hard for anyone in the system to handle. And I'm going to tell you, when you get onto this systemic stuff, Tommy Weisskopf started winning, won 6 golf tournaments in a row after his dad died. And when they'd interview him, Tom would say, God, I wish my dad was here to see this. See, why was it that he suddenly could start winning the golf tournaments after his father died? I'll bet you anything, and I don't know this for a fact, that dad had a message to him, don't you ever be better than me. Don't you ever be better than me. And that, you know, you don't ever achieve more than I have in this family system. So the idea that I could, you know, a healthy family wants you to be happy and be with your community and working for world peace. If you had healthy people, they'd want you. They'd love you and affirm you and want you to have your individuality. And not be into their own narcissism and their own neediness. So you come home to take care of me so I'm not lonely. That's not about you that they want to see you when they're putting all that guilt on you. It's about them. It's about their neediness. The people I love, and thank God I've had the therapy I've had. My son's leaving me, and I've cried about it, and it's painful. He's 17. He holds a crucifix up when I come in the room. I think that's normal 17-year-old. I'll tell you in about 10 years. I'll say, John, how's it going? Fine. What happened to school today? Nothing. Did you have a good day? Yes. And then he's out of the room. And it's, see, I'm needy. And I said, you know, I gave him the money to go to Europe recently. I never was on an airplane until I was 21. Comes back from Europe. Well, how was it? How's Michelangelo? He's dead. You know, I paid $1,800 for this trip. By God, you're going to share with me. And I want some gratitude. See, that's not about this kid. He's trying to puberty. And that's real hard to do. This kid's trying to be an adolescent. He's trying to find an identity. He's trying to leave a very powerful father and have a life of his own. I need to get off of my own neediness. You get it that that's about me? That's not about him? He needs a father he can count on. Who's not pouting every time he comes in the house. This child's trying to grow up
and do the hardest transition in the life cycle, which is adolescence. And it's hardest on parents, too. I wouldn't let anybody have one until they had hung around some adolescents. If it was up to me, I'd have home ec courses you got to go hang around with adolescents before you start having babies. And really get what that's about and have them carry babies around and you can't put them in your locker. You know, and just really get what it's about to be a parent, because I wouldn't let anybody do it under 30 if it was up to me. Any 15-year-old with a blood test can have a child. Not even with a blood test. Any 15-year-old can have a child. You need more training to be a telephone operator answer. You get more training than you do to be a mother or a daddy. So needy people find each other, and then they figure out after they get married and the love, you know, the in love is over, the romance is over. See, when we're courting, we don't let the other person know about our neediness. But as soon as you get married, then the unconscious contract of two needy people is, guess what, you're my mother. Guess what, you're my daddy. See, if you haven't worked through those source relationships. I was a wonderful charmer. When I came out of the seminary, I dated for about 5 years, and boy, I would just charm and send roses and flowers and gentle John. And then as this woman would start loving me, here would come all the rage from the setup with mother. And it would start with little things like, well, you're not going to wear your hair like that, are you? And then it would end with raging at her at a certain point. And see, the woman would always be just totally amazed that this gentle poet, you know, had this raving side to him. And see, I never got it that was about that I had never left my mother. That I was still bonded to her, I was still married to her. How can you love somebody else if you're still married to your mother? And I see this over and over again in males, because there's so few bonding. Fathers aren't in the home anymore. Boys can't bond with fathers in order to break the bonding with mothers. And as a boy is controlled by a mother and becomes her little man, then he's got a lot of rage about that. But it's unconscious, because you're set up not to be able to get mad at your mother, because you honor your parents, and at the second you express that, people are calling you ungrateful. And so you're set up. And so that anger gets acted out on every woman in my life. My wife used to say, wouldn't matter what I did, you're going to be angry. And until I divorced my mother, that was true. So these are real big problems, and two needy people come together, they're not going to be able to take care of each other, so guess what? At a certain point, they say, let's have a child. And the child, then, in dysfunctional families, is set up to take care of the parents' emotional needs. People don't grasp it. We say it over and over again. You've been taking care of your parents' feelings. What that means is, whenever you had a feeling that they didn't like, they told you to stop having that feeling to please them. And do you get it that what we now understand about emotional life is that people need to be connected to their feelings? Why? You can't have your feelings if you numb out, cut them off, repress them. They don't go away. They're energy. So I couldn't have my anger as a child. Guess what? Every once in a while, I would lose it. What does that mean? You say, I lost my temper today. Where'd you lose it? You know, I don't know what came over me, people will say. God, I don't know what happened. Boy, did I lose it today. See, do you get it? You can't repress those feelings and not have them come out. Or they'll come out passive-aggressively, which is really bad. That's like licking a big St. Bernard dog and having a big St. Bernard dog licking you and having him peeing on you at the same time. That's passive-aggressive. The anger will come out somewhere. The anger will come out somewhere. Okay? So this issue of getting in touch with our own feelings, all addictions are ways to manage feelings. All addictions are about shame-based broken relationships. And that's what happens in dysfunctional families. Anyone from a dysfunctional family is codependent. Anyone who's addicted is codependent. You're codependent first. Carl Menninger, in my AA talk, I used to talk about alcoholism as a disease of a disease. I was quoting Carl Menninger in his book, Man Against Himself. He said, an alcoholic is a man, woman, running into the sea to put out the fire, but drowning. It's a disease of a disease. You've got to stop the drinking because it's primary, progressive, pervasive, permanent, and terminal. But once you stop the drinking, and this is what Bobby Earle and I and others and why we're controversial, because we're going into these programs and saying, hey, it's not enough just to behavior modify this drinking. You got to deal with the core, the hole in your soul, the insatiable child that never gets enough, the compulsivity. That's the disease of the disease. And another word for that is codependency. Codependency is a set of adaptive behaviors to survive with. If you're codependent, you have been abandoned, including neglect, enmeshment, and abuse. See, I define abandonment as neglect, enmeshment, and abuse. Codependency is a symptom of abuse. Pure and simple. And so what happens is, and why this work is important, is that if you don't connect with what happened to you, you keep thinking it's about you. You keep thinking you need to control everything. That's just a quirk. That's just your own idiosyncratic personality quirks. You're hypervigilant. That's just your own idiosyncratic personality quirks. You have a lot of physical illnesses. You're dissociated. You don't have relationships. You're either an offender in the relationship or a victim in the relationship, or you have this victor-offender ambiguity. All of that is a response to the way you've been violated. It's a post-traumatic stress symptom. And you see, if we don't connect, this has been the major work of the people in Minnesota, people like Terry Kellogg, try to help us focus on what happened to us, how we were violated. And see, violence is violation. It's not just knocking your head off. If you saw your mother beaten, you were a victim of violence. If you were threatened by tonight your father's coming home, you're already a victim of violence, whether he ever spanks you or not. People yelling at you are violating you. People jerking you across the room, slapping you across the face, are violating you. Sexually abusing you, using you for their own needs, the very people that are supposed to be your caretakers. That's why sexual abuse has shock in it, the upper respiratory. It's so shocking to a person to have that happen to them. So do you understand that any of this kind of abuse, physical, emotional, intellectual, what do you know? Who gave you that stupid idea? Where'd you get an idea like that? Violation of your intellectual. And of course this happens in schools too, and it happens in churches. So codependency is a cultural phenomenon. Why do we talk about 95% of people being codependent? And why is this movement spreading all over the country with people who 15 years ago would have never called themselves codependent? Would have never said, I really have a problem. Because our culture, our churches, our sex roles are perfect codependent roles. Our idea of marriage is a codependent thing. Listen to the kicker songs. Stand by your man. You know, he can kick you, he can spit on you, he can... But you stand by him, honey. You light up my life. I'm a piece of dung without you, baby. That's what those songs are saying. They're saying, I can't live without you. That's straight codependency. I can't live without you is straight codependency. You have no inner life. You have no life of your own. So what happens, codependents get in relationships. The relationships end. Got to learn that the goal of life is to move from environmental support to self-support. That healthy people support themselves from within. Codependents depend on the outside for all their happiness. Healthy people generate their happiness from the inside. Generate their own good feelings from the inside. not from the outside. My happiness is not dependent on my wife or my children. It's depending on my own inner self. Do you see the problem? So codependency isn't something new. Shakespeare was writing about it. The love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, T.S. Eliot's great poem. You know, Prufrock. I've seen the moment of my greatness flicker and watch the eternal footman hold my coat and snicker. And in short, I was afraid I should have been a pair of ragged claws scuttling across the floors of silent seas. But I am pinned and wiggling on the wall. I've seen my head brought in like John the Baptist. See, he's always fantasizing, but he's always afraid. And he hides in this little kind of behind this facade, and he has no inner life. God, T.S. Eliot was writing a poem for a whole generation of the 20s. He quoted from the spirit of Guido and Dante's Inferno at the beginning of that poem. If I thought anybody could hear me, I would not answer you. I'm in hiding. Okay. So what I'd like to do with you, if you're beginning to identify with any of this... About 10 people came up to me last night and said, "Good God, it's like you just beat me up." And that isn't my purpose, to run around beating people up. But my purpose is to know how deep the delusion and the denial is. And how easy it is to sweep the stuff that's painful under the rug. And I'm not into pain, believe me. Believe me, I'm not into pain. In fact, I'm almost addicted to whatever feels good. But what I know is no pain, no gain. Buddha's first noble truth is that life is suffering. The Jews had to go through bondage in Egypt. They had to cross the Red Sea. They had to journey in the desert to get to the promised land. Jesus says there's no resurrection without crucifixion. The spiritual masters all talk about the training, the discipline, the going into the desert, the symbol of the desert. In order to get to life. So it's terribly important that we get it that this is a part and parcel of life. There are places in the heart, Leon Blois says, that do not yet exist. Pain must be in order that they be. There are places in the heart that do not yet exist. Pain must be in order that they be. Gibran, the deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. Is not the cup that holds your wine, the very cup that was burned in the potter's oven? Is not the lute that plays your music, the very lute that was whittled with knives? What a strange thing is pleasure in pain, that you can't have one without the other. That you can't have one without the other. Without a hurt, a heart is hollow. When the day has been too weary and the night has been too long and you think that love is only for the lucky and the strong, just remember in the winter, far beneath the bitter snow, lies a seed that with the sun's love in the spring becomes a rose. Albert Camus, in the midst of winter, I found within me an invincible summer. See, that pain will drive us back. It will bring us to what's great in us, to ourselves. But if we avoid the pain, you know, somebody said the job of therapy is to take you out of your misery into your pain. What a cruddy job. Okay. Now, in order to really get this stuff and break through my delusion and denial, what I believe is that people really, lots of us, are going to have to get to the feelings about it. And what I've given you in these notes, just disregard the first page, because that's something I'm going to talk about this afternoon. But if you look at the first page, it says a first step worksheet. Now, what I was told when I went into my 12-step program is that you've got to believe that you're powerless and your life's unmanageable, or you're not going to do anything about it. That until I believe that I'm powerless and that something's unmanageable, I'm not going to do anything about it. And so one of the values, see, a lot of you can say, "God, I identify with what Bradshaw's talking about up there. Boy, that my family was like this, and my dad was a rageaholic, and yes, I have trouble with my feelings, and I hyperventilate, and I'm hypervigilant, and I'm afraid of authority, and I've married addicts, and But you're still not doing anything. If I say, are you in a program? What are you doing about it? You say, well, I haven't quite done anything about it yet. So you're still in delusion and denial. And, you know, not my job to, you know, pontificate and try to make anybody get into to their recovery program. But I can only share with you that I was 11 years in my own sobriety before I got onto any of this. Bobby Earle's sharing, you know, he was years and years in sobriety and still feeling suicidal. And many of us are telling the story that we hadn't dealt with the codependency. We hadn't dealt with the codependency issues. Now the major thing I deal with are the codependency issues. And I am doing recovery for codependency. And I want to recommend it to you. And one of the things that I want to recommend is that you write out a first step. That is, if you've gotten connected with a lot of the things I was talking about last night or this morning, then I'm going to show you how to do a first step. And the goal of this step is to get you into the feelings about it so that you can feel, and that the next time there's a tendency to be nice in a relationship and rescue somebody and do a bunch of things that you don't want to do, you will have experienced the pain that that behavior is costing you and the life-damaging consequences of it so that you will not do it. I'm almost 22 years sober. The thought of a drink never occurs to me. I mean, you could all be smoking dope right now and it could be surrounding me and I will not do it. The pain of that stuff is so great and the memory of that pain is still so great. I can see myself in R&I Ward 8 in Austin State Hospital right this minute. I can see myself laying in a room with eight other people in a room about the size of a corner over here, with people going into electroconvulsive therapy, and me walking to the dining room with another alcohol addict back to back so they didn't knife us because they hate alcoholics. They don't think we're sick enough in state hospitals. I'll never forget this. I, who was going to be a priest, who was going to Europe to study with Karl Rahner, who was the first of the first in honor philosophy. What am I doing in a state house? I'll never forget that. You couldn't do anything to get me to take it. The pain, the emotion. Now, you got to get emotion about your codependency because that's what will fuel you and move you to work on it. And that's what writing does. When you write it, there's neurological data about what happens when we write stuff. There's neurological data that supports that writing is much better than just talking about it. So, when I say this worksheet should be written out, the example should be specific and should include feelings. Unless you have your feelings for how destructive your chemical use is. Now, we use this in our center, and our center focuses a lot on chemical addiction. But you don't just supply the word, your codependency. How destructive your codependency has been, you'll have little reason for continuing a recovery program if you don't feel it. The next time the urge to use or the urge to act out codependently, you'll easily be able to erase the memory, but you will not easily be able to erase the feelings. Okay? Now, turn over to the next page. That's the rationale. That is the rationale for writing it out. Now, we don't have time this morning for you to write it all out. What I'm encouraging you to do is I want to take you through it, and then I'm going to encourage you to do this for yourself. Love yourself enough. Care about yourself enough to go ahead and do this. And if you're a person that comes from a reasonably functional family, you're one of those few percentages, this can still be valuable as an inventory to kind of catch up with yourself. What I've done in this inventory is I've taken the letters of the word codependence. And on the left-hand side of the page, I've written a trait of codependency. And the first step in 12-step program says we were powerless and our life is unmanageable. See, what all of us try to do is control this stuff. I quit drinking every Lent for years. I've been on 5,000 diets. I have lost 5,000 pounds. We know that 2% of diets work, that fat is a family affair, and so is bulimia and anorexia and the fat-thin disorder, which I carry, which is the obsessing on food. You either obsessing about not eating, and then I go eat a donut, and then I eat a donut, and I say, well, I eat a donut. What the heck? And I eat 10 donuts. Or I eat Bluebell cookies and cream ice cream till I can't feel my mouth. And then I start putting on weight, and then I obsess on the weight, and then I go into my running program and my nutritional program and no sugar and I do that for a while. See, control, and that's just another side of shame. Control is one of the ways not to deal with your shame. You've got to surrender. The only way out of this stuff is to surrender. I'm powerless and my life is unmanageable. Take me! I need help. That is the only way out of this stuff. You can't control it. You can't say, well, I think I'll control my codependency tomorrow. Not without a group, not without consciousness raising, not without staying on top of it, because the second you get away from this stuff, you go right back into the dysfunctional roles. Now, forever? Do you have to do it forever? Maybe not. I think I will, and I'm okay with that. But maybe you don't. But you have to do it for a while. And I recommend that you have some kind of group that you're in where people are dealing with these issues that you can talk about it. I recommend the Adult Children of Alcoholics, the codependency groups, the Al-Anon groups, for dealing with codependent type issues. The right-hand side of the page has a trait, and the first trait is the core of the self is shame-based. Then on the right-hand side of the page, unmanageability, and for those listening to the tapes, I'm going to read all of this, being perfect or being a slob. How many of you are perfectionistic? And then think of times in your life where you're driven by that perfectionism. You're driven by it to where it's controlling you, you're not controlling it. Try to think of a life-damaging consequence in actual behavior that you can write down that goes with that trait that the core of self is shame-based. And last night I talked about shame. I'll say a few more things. Shame is experienced as a painful feeling of being exposed and flawed as a human being. So shame dreams are about being naked or caught with your pants down or panties down. That somebody sees you, that you're exposed. I remember working with a woman, a very beautiful woman, who was engaged to a blind guy at one point in her life so that he would never see her body. Very shame-based family. Very rattled with shame. But see, shame is about being seen. I can remember being in bars and a guy would look over at me. Just look at me. And I'd say, what are you looking at? Or do you remember as a kid where you're getting punished and your sister comes in the room? You say, get her out of here. She's looking at me. That's about shame. Shame is when you're being exposed when you're not ready to be exposed. You're little bitty. Eric Erickson says it's like you don't have eyes and you're behind. So a lot of it's around toilet training and the terrible twos that shame is being developed. And a good sense of shame needs to be developed. Remember, a good sense of shame, healthy shame is, it's okay to make a mistake. It's okay to be finite. Being human is to make mistakes. If you're human, you're going to make mistakes. So when I'm wrong, I can promptly admit it. That's what the 10th step tells me in my 12-step program. And the 10th step is what relieves me from having to play God. See, neurotic shame is playing God because you're always hiding. And that's why I've put spiritual bankruptcy at the top there. Because neurotic shame is playing God. Somebody defined codependency as a conflict of gods. Codependency is a conflict of gods. You make your husband your God.
You make your children your God. You make your wife your God. You make your lover your God. You make alcohol, cocaine your God. You make work your God. You make money your God. You sell your soul. You become a slave and you find a new God. Paul Tillich used to say, the great Lutheran theologian, your God is your ultimate concern. Every addiction is an aborted religion. It has a God. It has disciples and devotees. It has rubrics and ritual. When you smoke the joint, you pass it a certain way. There's a whole ritual that goes with the addiction. It has its atonement, its moment of ecstasy. See? And I believe that all addicts, all people who are codependent, are spiritually bankrupt. And that our deepest need is spirituality. Our deepest need. That every time I acted out in any way, I was seeking God in an aborted form. I was trying to get to ecstasy, but I didn't know how. And that the drug was a way to get to ecstasy, but I didn't know how. I didn't know how healthily to get to transcendence. And it's why the healing of codependency, we'll talk about this afternoon, is going to be what we started today with, meditation and prayer and inner life and what I call the third stage of recovery. As we get into higher consciousness and higher self, we got to be careful not to do that too soon, because it can become the most subtle form of delusion and denial if you do it too soon. And I have seen people in astral traveling and higher consciousness that are still very sick people. And you need to be really attentive to the possibility that just because people are talking about God or higher consciousness or spirituality, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're healthy. And by their fruit you will know them and what they do. Don't listen to what people say they do. Watch what they do. And do you walk the walk when you talk the talk? See, we want people to walk the walk if they're going to talk the talk. And believe me, I've talked the talk when I have not been walking the walk. And I love to hear my voice when I'm talking the talk, when I'm not walking the walk. And somehow I go away when I talk the talk and say, well, I'm doing good, aren't I? And that takes the place of walking the walk. And that's a crock. And the one that's getting screwed is me. And that's what I finally figured out, that I'm the one losing out. So, the core of shame. Good shame is I can make a mistake. I need help. Good shame is I am not God. So shame, good healthy shame, is the source of spirituality. And that's why in the 12-step programs, by the time you get to step 10, you've come back to that healthy sense of shame. See, no neurotically shamed person will admit they made a mistake. Do you get that one? It's like, once you're neurotically shamed, and what do I mean by that? There are three ways that that happens. Children at 2 begin to get shamed. And shame is a sudden rupture of expectation. See, I thought I was doing okay. I'm having a great time. I'm eating this stuff. And all of a sudden, that big giant's going crazy. And their veins are sticking out. And I'm being slapped or I'm being jerked across the room. Now, shame not only is exposure, but it's the breaking of the interpersonal bridge. So last night when I was talking about how to treat shame, you've got to get into community. Shame is broken. You can't have shame unless you've got a significant relationship. See, if I don't care about one of you and you call me, and a woman called me a communist the other day. God, that's the first time anybody did that. Well, I didn't think about that very much. But another guy said, you're quite a performer. Well, I thought about that for weeks. It's like as they get closer to home, it's harder to deal with. And this was also somebody that I had some respect for. Or aren't you hamming it up too much, I think they said, something like that. The self is ruptured. See, once that interpersonal bridge is broken, trust is broken. So shame-based people don't trust anymore. That's why codependents try to control everybody.
See, if I really trusted that the facts are friendly, Carl Rogers says, the facts are friendly, the universe is friendly, that I can trust what Milton Erickson said, your deep unconscious, that the unconscious is always trying to get more life for us, that we can trust nature's great impulsive heart. We can trust it. We can trust the universe. We can trust ourselves. When you're shame-based, you stop trusting your own eyes. What do I know? See, I thought I had this relationship, and it was disrupted. Sudden rupture. So one of the ways that healthy shame becomes neurotic shame is that you get shamed. All these shaming events. Abandonment. I'm worth less than my father's time. Any kind of abandonment is going to shame. What do you feel that for? There's nothing to feel that for. What are you angry about? There's nothing to be angry. Don't you ever talk to your mother like that again. See, that's all. It shames your emotions now. So all the emotions get shamed. They get shame-bound. Your needs get shamed. When I was needy, my mother was needy. Poor thing, she was trying to deal with an alcoholic husband who wasn't supporting us. She had to go to work as a department store clerk. When Mama would come home, how could I want to sit in her lap? She pushed me away. So now when I feel needy, I feel shame. Your needs get shame-bound. How many of you can ask somebody to help you? Just really ask them to help you. See, and isn't that the hard thing, those of you who are in the programs, to go to those programs the first time? Because when you walk through the door, you're saying, I need help. See how that's your healthy shame? Healthy shame says, we all need help. We all need help. This strong, silent, individual, don't ever surrender, win at any cost, manly role. Is saying, you know, we all need help. We need each other. We need to network. We need a threshold of consciousness for world peace. We need to come together and meditate and be together. We need to do that. We need each other. There's no one of my brothers I can do without. In the heart of the meanest miser, the most squalid prostitute, the most miserable drunkard, there is an immortal soul with holy aspirations, which, deprived of daylight, worships in the night. I need them all in my praise of God. There's not one of them I can do without. We are the world. We are the people. Every spiritual master has said at the highest moments of consciousness, we get it, that there's no separation. That it's only ego that creates the maya and the illusion. But you've got to have a healthy ego, and anybody's codependent doesn't even have an ego. Anybody codependent doesn't even have an ego structure. We don't have any inner ego structure. We've been deprived of our developmental dependency needs. We've been shamed. We don't have anything we can count on. Because we couldn't count on what the outside is. See, a child learns to count on themselves by having someone they can count on. A child learns to depend on themselves by having someone who's dependable. Children need structure. I used to try with John Jr. You know, I was reading him stories, and I try to, well, I call it skipping pages. I'd turn two pages at the same time. You ever tried that with one of your kids? They'll say, wait a minute, Daddy. And I don't care. He was 3 years old, he'd do that. And what that's about is his need for structure. See, the world needs to be predictable. And when you wake up in the morning, it's predictable. You can count on it. When kids are shamed, they can't count on anything anymore. And they break the interpersonal bridge with those significant others, so we go inside into isolation and aloneness. Now, the cover-ups for shame, then, are the unmanageability on the right side of the page. You become perfect, or you just be a slob. So I'm going to do a film in Los Angeles on shame, and I hope to have one scene of a guy shooting up in an alley and another guy is the head of a corporation running the, you know, chairman of the board, controlling everybody with all the power. And not every chairman of the board or every corporation president is shame-based, but a whole lot of the ones I've dealt with are. That their need for power and control and money is about being driven by the inner sense of self-rupture.
And that the cover-ups for shame are control, power, perfectionism, contempt, criticism, rage. Those are all the ways we cover up the shame. So you can be a slob or you can be perfect. You try to control everyone or you're passive dependent. You hide behind a false self. You're always pretending. You're always in an act. You're guarded lest you ever be caught off guard. God, the energy that takes. See, the only thing you don't have to work at is to be yourself. That's the only thing that doesn't take any work. Putting these masks up takes a lot of work and a lot of energy. Being a people, feeling ashamed of feelings and needs. And then, of course, the other thing that gets shamed is your drives, sexuality. Little Farquhar finds his ear one day and everybody goes crazy. They call Grandma over. Grandma, watch this. Farquhar, show Grandma your ear. Ear. Grandma freaks out. Little Farquhar's on a roll. He goes to the grocery store and shows him his ear. Then one day he finds his nose. Blows everybody away. Then he finds his elbow. And he finds his belly button. And then one Sunday, with the preacher in the living room, and he thinks, man, if the nose got him, this is really going to get him. So he goes in there and shows him his penis. And he has never been escorted out of a room so fast. By the ear. Looking at that big giant's face. And boy, he gets the message there'll be no genitals in this family. And so your sex drive gets shamed. So a lot of people can't get turned on unless it's shameful. Unless it's illicit. Or you can court and have wild passionate sex and you get married and it's familiar and illicit and people start turning off. The most common sexual dysfunction is disorder of desire. And isn't this a tragedy? I mean, to live with someone you love and be turned off so you can't function sexually. So that's the drives are shame. People have been shamed at the dinner table. A lot of weight problems are around having to sit in exile at dinner tables. Sitting there till you clean your plate. Shaming your drives. Shaming going to the bathroom. So this is all part of what happens in shame. So you become a people pleaser, a nice guy or a sweetheart. That was my role. Gentle John, nice guy. God isn't John nice. And I am nice, by the way. I really am nice. But I also, like every human being, have a polarity, a shadow side. That's a mean little kid. To believe that anybody is as nice as they seem and not realize that everybody's got that other side is just illusion. An old Malaysian saying, you can't know a person outside of their hut. You want to know a man, go in his hut. In her hut. Go ask Nancy about nice guy John. And she'll tell you some other stuff. I think that it's okay. I own that part of me. And I'm not ashamed of it. But I work on it a lot. I don't want to be, but I can be cantankerous and mean and just cross and nasty mood inflection and verbally, abusive. Being a nice guy or sweetheart, or raging and blaming. Staying isolated and messed up because you feel you have no right to depend on anyone. See, part of the hardest thing, shame is total. Everything is not okay. Once you've internalized the shame, then nothing's okay about you. So you got to put up a false self. And I think that you could define codependency as internalized shame. And there are degrees of it. In some people, it's more intense than in others. Shame was the demon that I had never named. I was 12, 14 years in recovery before I named this demon. And Bob was sharing that with me. Kip Flock, my friend in Los Angeles, therapist friend. Many of us, shame has been the most important discovery of our lives, to be able to name this demon. Because once you begin to come out in the open and be exposed, and so I deliberately expose myself, because it's important for me, not sexually, but I deliberately tell about what's going on because it keeps me sane and it keeps me grounded. And it's important for me to break the no-talk rule. And, you know, Mama would go out and be wonderful with the neighbor lady, Miss Hampton, come back in and start raging at us. And it was always be nice and look good. So the second characteristic, I call it the otheration or the Zelig phenomena. Did any of you see the movie Zelig, where Woody Allen becomes anybody he's with? See, that's perfect codependency. Like in codependent relationships, what you'll tend to do if you're real codependent is you'll continually try to minimize the differences. If they like hot dogs, you'll start liking hot dogs. If they like to go to football games, you start going to football games. Or you go even though you don't like them and pretend like you like them. But see, you don't have a life of your own. So the Zelig phenomena is this otheration, experienced as overreacting to things outside of self and underreacting to the things inside of self. Dependency problems. Impression management. You're always trying to impress. How's it going to look? And you make your decisions about how things look, not about what you want. Now, you know, everybody probably does some of that. We're taught to do that in this society. What do you do when you reach a certain level? You have the right, you have got to have the right kind of car if you live in this neighborhood. Your kids have to go to a certain kind of school. Look at the image. In River Oaks in Houston, which is the wealthy part of Houston, man. And I work with a lot of those people. I'm kind of an apostle to the upper middle class. And somebody's got to do it. But I mean, how people are all jailed by having to live up to this image of being in the country club. Some of them can't afford it. And they're having to scrimp, but they're going to stay in that country club no matter what. So everybody will know that they're still up there socially. Impression management, relationship addiction, excessive responsibility for meeting others' needs to the exclusion of your own, belief that happiness lies outside of you. See, there's where the addiction... Addicts always believe that something outside of them is their happiness. If I can just put that booze in me, then I feel okay. If I can just have that relationship, if I can just make money, if I just have a kind of car, then I'll be okay. And happiness is inside of us. So, the unmanageability. My self-worth comes from being approved of by someone outside of me. You don't feel like you have any worth unless everybody likes you. God! I have gone to enormous lengths when I've heard somebody didn't like me. I do not do that anymore. You just can't please all the people all the time. I look like somebody's uncle or somebody's cousin who they hate. And no matter what I do, they don't like me. Well, I used to kill myself trying to get everybody in the audience to like me. And if one person didn't like the talk, I'd go into a funk for 2 weeks, 2 months sometimes. It's enough to drive you crazy. Life-damaging consequences. Write that out. How many of you have obsessed on what somebody said to you for weeks and weeks and weeks and been dominated and controlled by it and given up your life to it? That's the symptom, being a caretaker, a martyr, a rescuer, an enabler. That is, you're always taking care of other people and neglecting your own needs. You don't know what you want. You come home and you know you want to go to a show and you know what show you want to see. But you come home and say, would anyone like to go to a show? Now they've got 51 choices to get this right. Oh no, they only got 2 choices to get this one right. They say, yes, let's go to a show. And then you say, well, what show would y'all want to see? See, instead of saying, I want to go to the show and I want to go see the whatever, would anyone like to go with me? The codependent goes in there and says, would anyone like to go to a show? Being nice. And then what show would you like? Now they got 51 chances to get it right. And if they get it wrong, then you go to the show and hate them all through the show. They didn't even know what you wanted. Caretaker, you'll give up your reality to take care of people, and your worth comes from taking care of people. My going to be a priest was to be a caretaker. I thought I wasn't worthy unless I was taking care of people. And you see, caretaking and enabling is severe dishonesty. Because it sounds like and it looks like you're doing it for the other people, but you're really not. You're doing it for you. You're doing it so your image of yourself as a good person can be restored. And that's what all, you know, what helped me more than anything with this was to get it that I was doing a lot of my counseling for me and not for the people I was counseling. I was killing myself saying it was for people, but it was really because of my shame. Making yourself indispensable so that your partner can't leave you. So you do everything for them. You do everything for them. You nurse them back to health and they sneeze, you're there with a handkerchief. And pretty soon they become so dependent on you they can't leave you. See, that's your abandonment issue. That's not about loving your partner. You can't say goodbye to anybody. I have notes from 1947 that I keep hauling on every move that I've never looked at. But I can't let them go. Do you see that? Making yourself, I'm aware of your feelings, needs, and wants before I'm aware of my own. This helps, you know, I'm a good counselor because I know what you feel before I know what I feel. But it also, you know, it's important to know what I feel. You make decisions on the basis of what others think, want, or expect. Your self-worth comes from solving other people's problems rather than your own problems. So you're a minister and you're helping everybody in the neighborhood and your kids are all starving for your love and affection over here. And believe me, I have worked with these families. I've worked with ministers who were the darlings of the community, and their kids are like orphans over here. The wife is dying over here of need for intimacy and love. And dad's the big, wonderful guy that everybody loves. You live an apathetic, passionless life versus being in a relationship with others who are exciting and passionate in order to experience aliveness through them. See, a lot of times you marry this wild, crazy guy so you can feel the excitement because you can't have it, you can't engender it from within. So again, it's like getting all your supplies, all your narcissistic supplies from the outside. It's like getting a fix because you don't have anything on the inside. Barren, spiritually bankrupt, a hole in the soul. Let's take a break. Bobby Earl is going to tell. Some of you are asking me, like, boy, you're really identifying this stuff. Where do you go for meetings? We'll have some people in the group stand up so that you can recognize some faces and go talk to them, and they'll tell you some places to go. One thing that I think is important, and I do this, and I need to be careful about, is that some of you don't know what 12-step groups are. The basic 12-step group was founded by Bill W. and Dr. Bob, the AA recovery program. The 12 steps are a suggested program of recovery, beginning with the first step. We were powerless and our life was unmanageable. And the belief that step, these 12 steps have been taken over by other groups like Cocaine Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Emotions Anonymous, Families Anonymous, Al-Anon, which is sort of the original codependent group, the spouses of addicts, realizing that they also were addicted, that is, they were addicted to their spouses. Now they're beginning to be, Mary Jackson was telling me last night that there's like 117 CODA meetings, codependency meetings, and that some are getting started here. And basically, you go to these meetings and you share your experience, strength, and hope. You share with each other. When you go to a 12-step meeting, you're not going to be therapized. Or if you are, somebody's getting it wrong. You know, if somebody comes up to you and starts doing therapy with you, that's out of order. That these are groups where we just come together as equal. The principle of anonymity is that we're all equal. That nobody's a guru, nobody's distinguished, and that everybody comes out of their experience, strength, and hope, and out of their pain. It's kind of a healthy shame that we all acknowledge that we need help. And so we come together, and the groups help each other. The second step is we believe that something greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I always hated this step because I didn't like what it implied. The opposite of sanity is insanity. Sanus in Latin means health, so insanus is out of health. That's a way to euphemize it. We believe that something greater than ourselves, See, so immediately, a poor shame-based person who's broken off all relationships begins to be open to a relationship. And shame, remember I said shame is hopeless? So the third step says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore sanity. The third step says we made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God as we understand Him. We might say, even add, as we understand her now, or it, or them, or whatever. But the beautiful thing is that it's your own understanding. But the belief is, see, spiritual bankruptcy, that you begin by establishing a relationship with something greater than ourselves. See, if my dad didn't love me, why would I trust one of you? If I couldn't trust my dad, if I couldn't trust my mom, why would I trust you? And boy, I didn't trust anybody in the beginning when I went to those meetings. And the fourth step is we took a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves to find out the exact nature of our wrongs. You see, and that's a step that can easily be adapted to what I've been sharing with you, is that when I did that step, I began to see that behind all my behavior was fear, and then I now see that behind all my behavior is shame. And that the exact nature of my wrong was that shame I was carrying. And a lot of that was about what happened to me, not about me. And so it's a moral inventory, not an immoral inventory. It's a way that I can begin to accept myself and to get it that I have, you know, these things have happened. This abandonment has happened to me. Then the fifth step is you tell another human being. So that's coming out of hiding. Now here we're going to really deal with the shame. Also, if you know the Bible, the book of Genesis says there were four broken relationships with God, with self, with our brother, and with the world. So we restore the relationship with God. We start restoring the relationship with ourself. And now we're restoring the relationship with our brother. So 5, 6, and 7 are where I admit to another human being the exact nature of my wrongs. I'm willing to have God remove these defects of character. See, because the will is disabled in codependency. I'm going to come to that in a minute. That when you're codependency, you don't have your will available. You don't make good choices. And you become very grandiose. One of the next characteristics is extremes. It's all or nothing. That's a dysfunctional will to make things all or nothing. Trying to control things you can't control. Well, if I'm just nicer to my alcoholic husband, he's going to get well. If I can just come to one of these seminars and learn some tricks how to get him well, trick him into getting well. See, that's trying to control what can't be controlled. And the program doesn't ever say, you know, you're going to cure codependency. I never gave up drinking except one day at a time. Because all I can handle is one day at a time. You can't will sobriety. You can will to live one day at a time. You can't will happiness. You can will to take responsibility for your life. Do y'all see the difference in that? That it's this grandiose, I'm willing happiness, and this is a will that's out of order. So to become willing is to admit that I'm flawed. That's another way to overcome the shame. And so the 6 and 7 are a way that we come out of hiding. We're willing to be limited. Then 8 and 9 are amends steps. You make a list of all the people you've harmed. Because even though I am a victim of abandonment, I did some dastardly things. And it's not excusing me for my behavior. And I want everybody to hear that. It's not when I say, I get it that I was abandoned, I'm not blaming my parents, I'm finding out what happened to me, I also did some horrible things, so I need to make amends. So I make a list of all the people that I've harmed. Then the next step is I make amends wherever possible, except where it would harm me. As a teenager, I stole money. Well, I sent that money back anonymously. I was not about to go say, I'm the guy that stole from you. Because there was real danger of that affecting me. I'm working with some sex addicts right now. There's some issues about them making amends that are not, that they have to be real careful about.
But there is the point of restoring the relationship with my brothers by making amends. Then step 10 says, when we were wrong, promptly admit it. Now we begin maintenance. Now I'm in touch with my good, healthy shame, so it's okay to make mistakes. And one of the great things about 12-step programs, Al-Anon, ACOA, support groups, is that you're accepted there because you've got problems. We don't want no perfect people there. We'll kick you out if you come in there perfect. And you start acting perfect around us and we'll get you. Because that just doesn't work for us. And I don't want people one-upping each other. We've got to stay in that. Humility is the spiritual virtue we're talking about. Good shame is humility. Unhealthy shame, neurotic shame is pride, if you want religious terms for it. 11 is we sought through prayer and meditation to increase our conscious contact with God as we understand her, him, it, them. So now we're coming into spiritual maintenance. And we're now, Bill W. and Dr. Bob got it, that you haven't recovered until you have a spiritual life. And so 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. See how we're healing spiritual bankruptcy? I carry these messages to other suffering people. So I'm doing 12-step work by being a lecturer. Because now I'm restoring the relationship with God, with myself, and with my brothers and sisters. And out of that comes a growing inner life. I'll talk more this afternoon about what I think of as stages of recovery, but they basically follow these steps. These steps are magnificent. They can be used for anything, any kind of disorder that's overwhelming a person where you're out of control. So those are the 12 steps. AA uses those. All the 12-step programs use those steps. You go to meetings and you talk about how you're working the step. You hear other people talk about how they work the step. There are 12-step guidelines. There are books written to help people work the steps. But the important thing is to work them. And I used to go to meetings and talk about steps I'd never taken. Which is part of delusion and denial and grandiosity. So the important thing is to do it. Let's look some more. Next page. Delusion, denial, defenses. Another symptom. The D in codependency is delusion, denial, defenses. Experienced as denying and minimizing one's problems. Oh yeah, I drink some, but I got a lot of pressures on me. You know, this is a minimizing. Oh, yes, my husband does drink a lot, but really he's such a good guy with the children. And, he's so kind when he isn't beating me up. I probably couldn't find anyone as sweet as he is when he isn't raging and going crazy. See, that's minimizing. It's like you're in. Boy, just watch that tendency to minimize your pain. Because it's tough to do something about this. You minimize the problem itself, the impact on you, your feelings about it, and then I just add there all the primary defenses of childhood. That is, when you grow up in a dysfunctional family, you repress the feelings, you dissociate from them. One of you just shared with me at the break that you had been at the Meadows and you'd done the Survivor's Week. And you'd started getting in touch after 30 years of some memories from incest. See, because one of the worst things about sexual abuse is you dissociate from it. I mean, you literally go into outer space. You go traveling so that you're not there. When uncle's doing it, you're up on the ceiling. And dissociation's a great thing to know how to do. I have a talk I do on the strengths of codependency. And I'm glad I know how to dissociate. It got me through medieval Latin. It's wonderful. Just two guys, another seminarian and I, we used to have to sit there. It was the most boring professor I've ever had. And this guy would go to sleep and get in trouble. I'd just dissociate and grin at him the whole time. But I'd be in Hawaii having a big time during Latin. So I invite you to dissociate. If you get bored here, dissociate. That's a good thing to know how to do. But it's not good if you don't have a choice about it. So the problem with dissociation, conversion's an ego defense. When I feel needy, I call him and say, "You look like you need a hug." And you can get away with murder doing this if you're a counselor. "Well, I think you need a hug." And then I can go around getting hugs all day, but I'm the one who needs a hug. Or conversion. A lot of men can't. A man comes home from work, he's needy, he's had a bad day, he's been jacked around at work. What he really needs is just for someone to, his wife to hug him and hold him, maybe baby him. But he'll say, "I'm horny." You convert the neediness into horniness. Because a lot of men don't think they can be needy unless they're sexual. That's what we've been taught. So a lot of men affectionalize their sexuality. That is, they make, instead of just getting affection, it's got to be sex. Because the only way they can be vulnerable. The problem with those earliest defenses is that they're unconscious and automatic. So a lot of times we've got to confront you to break down those defenses. You can't know what you don't know. You can't heal what isn't real. You've got to make it real. If you're in, every child will idealize parents for survival purposes. See, I couldn't have stood up in my crib at four, or at four, come in with my bags packed and said, "Look, you're an alcoholic and you're codependent, and I'm moving down to the Farquhar's house. They look a lot saner than you are." See, I needed those parents totally for my survival. So a child will always... Robert Firestone has written a book called The Fantasy Bond. It is a powerful book. Robert Firestone, The Fantasy Bond. The more you are abused, the more you will fantasy bond. Somebody talked about slaveholders knowing that the more you enslave people, the lower their self-worth gets. The worse you treat somebody, especially if you have a great disproportion of power, the more their self-esteem lowers, they're shamed more, and their choices diminish. Battered women learned helplessness. We say, "Well, why don't you get out of that relationship? It's stupid for you to say that." We don't get it, that woman is bonded to that violence. That's like an addiction, to be bonded to the violence. That once somebody's abused you, you get bonded to it. You become bonded to the abuse. And it's not just a choice. It's an addiction. So it's not that easy. So you can't heal what isn't real. We've got to confront those defenses to get you to get it that you've idealized your parents for survival purposes. And again, what comes? Let me tell you what comes out of this. If you want to have a real relationship with your parents, you've got to work through this stuff. I have the best relationship with my mother I ever had because it's a relationship, not an enmeshment. And oh, she doesn't like me and she thinks I'm crazy half the time, but it's a relationship. I'm not bonded to her. See, if you're like this, you don't have a relationship. You're just enmeshed. There aren't two people there. It's two people in a canoe. If I move, you move. There are no boundaries between you. You got to have this to have a relationship. Two whole people. You play music together, but each one has their own instrument. I play the violin, you play the piano, but we can play the same song. But it's two whole people, not two half people making a whole. A half times a half equals a fourth. It doesn't work to be two half people. So our culture promotes that. All right, here's some of the kinds of behaviors. You tell yourself it's not really as bad. You overeat, get confused, get sick, become chronically depressed, and pretend none of these things are happening. You know, I'll say, "What's the consequence with you on this relationship?" "Oh, nothing. I have put on 50 pounds, and, you know, and I now smoke grass, and but it isn't that bad." You tell yourself it's hopeless and there's nothing you can do about it. I'm going to stop. Hopelessness is a symptom of codependency. And hopelessness is a form of grandiosity. I want you all to hear this. Because people will come into me and they'll say, "Well, there's nothing I can do about it." And see, they don't get it that's grandiose. See, I am so sick. I'm the best sickest that ever lived. And there's nothing anyone could do to help me. Now, I don't mean to say that the person doesn't really feel hopeless, because that shame has that all-pervasive totality about it. But what I want you to get is that you're not really hopeless. You're not really hopeless. that it feels hopeless, but you're not really hopeless. Because that's a form of grandiosity. You believe you can control what's happening if you really put your mind to it. See, codependents are always trying to figure stuff out. If there's a joke that there's two doors and one says, "Gateway to Heaven," the other says, "Lecture on Heaven." And all the codependents are lined up going into the lecture on heaven. The other joke that's going around is codependents are dying and they see someone else's life flash before their eyes. You feel numb all over. You don't know when you're tired or hungry or sick. You're numbed out. You've just cut off from all your feelings with your defenses. You feel a low-grade chronic depression, especially when you're alone. See, a lot of times when the noise dies down, or I go up to my little lake place I've got, and I really have to be aware that once there's no distraction, there's no fanfare, and I'm just with me, sometimes those feelings of depression, those old, you know, family system feelings will come on. And it's something to really be aware of, that if you lost yourself years and years ago, if you were soul murdered, see, depression is about loss. Always depression is about loss. So lots of us who lost ourselves are adult children of dysfunctional families, codependents. We have a low-grade chronic depression because we lost our reality. And so a lot of times in the inner child work that we do, there's just wonderful healing when you have that child available to you now. And I'll talk some more about that this afternoon. Extremes. Experienced is not knowing what normal is. See, Claudia Black, when she first wrote her stuff, Sharon Wegscheider, when the adult children of alcoholic movement began to come out, what these people would say over and over again, that what they grew up with they thought was normal because they had nothing to compare it with. So you never learned what normal is. You don't know what normal is. Or you were living with shame-based parents who were grandiose. You were all or nothing. You're unique or you're a worm. So here's some of the behaviors. And again, remember, I'm asking you to go over this and take your sheet of paper and write out an actual behavior, an actual incident in your life of how that relates to you. You trust everyone or you trust no one. So some codependents have walls around them. They don't have a relationship with anybody. Other codependents, you know, show me the gold mine. How much? I was talking last night about what my codependency has literally financially cost me. And I mean lots. When I did this step, I couldn't believe the amount of money my codependency has cost me. Being gullible, that's another characteristic of codependency. Believing everybody, trusting. Thank God for my wife. Because she is not gullible and she does not trust everybody and she saves me. I'm in the deal. These are the nicest guys you've ever seen. When I started doing my tapes, people were just ripping me off right and left. And I would never stand up for myself. And thank God Nancy is strong in those areas. We really complement each other. You trust everyone and you trust no one. You let everyone touch you won't let anyone touch you. So you're totally shut down sexually, or you sleep and you wake up and say, "What was your name again?" And a lot of sex, even a lot of what's called sexual addiction, isn't sexual addiction, it's codependency. It's not being able to say no to somebody, to be nice. And so you wind up sleeping with somebody you don't really want to sleep with because you don't want to hurt their feelings. You take responsibility for their feelings of rejection. Or they took me out and treated me real nice. I owe this to them. See, your sexual boundaries are your body boundary. We're going to talk about that in a minute as a trait of codependency, not having good boundaries. I mean, you have a right to say no to anything that's sexually about your body. You don't have to give any explanation for it or any reason for it. That is a body boundary, and don't let anybody tell you otherwise. But when your body's, when somebody can jerk you across the room, slap you across the face, hit you, shake you, your body's being violated. When somebody can take you sexually, play with you, touch you, your body's been violated. And the boundary's been violated. Little children need boundaries. They need to be able to lock bathroom doors and have their own boundaries, not have somebody come in on them. I could tell you stories that would stand your hair on end of what parents have done to children. Father examining his 13-year-old, spread eagle on the bed to be sure she's a virgin. Fundamentalist father, and she couldn't disobey him because he was her father. That religion demanded that. I mean, this is abomination under the name of God. You can't initiate anything, but once you start, you can't stop. I mean, I will beat around the bush, and then when I start, I want to do it forever. God, this is fun, and I don't ever want to stop. You can't initiate. You're super sweet or critical and abusive. You're over-responsible or under-responsible. See, and when you read the problematic, those of you who are adult children, you can. Terry Kellogg does a beautiful thing. He switches those. He'll take all the problem statement and change every one of them, and about half the people in the group can identify with them. Try that sometime. Read the problem statement. There's a problem statement in the adult children of alcoholics. If you go to a meeting, they read the problem, and it's we are manipulated, we're afraid of authority, we have a hard time knowing what we feel, we have difficulty being intimate in relationships. These are part of the problem. They're also symptoms of codependency. But you can make every one of them into an opposite and see that it's still a part of the problem. Because again, we don't know what normal is. We don't have any boundaries. The core of self has been violated. If I'm a pretend, I have to do what the pretend calls for. You have no opinion, or you're rigid and judgmental and know-it-all. You're totally involved, or you're isolated and alone. What a lot of codependents do is they get in relationships and they get all enmeshed. Then they go with them, they get terrible, and you can't get out of them. And finally, one day, you get out of them. And you say, boy, that's it. I'm never getting in a relationship again. And you go for months and months and months. No sex, no nothing. And you start getting lonely. And all of a sudden, some sweet-talking person comes and blows in your ear, and you follow them anywhere. And then pretty soon you're back in the relationship, see? And that isn't what needs to be done. What needs to be done is to heal the shame and build the boundaries. Look at the next page. Primary, progressive, pervasive. You tolerate more and more irresponsible behavior. Look at the unmanned. You start doing things you said you'd never do. Now, I want you to think about this in relationships you've been in. You have sex when you don't want to. You stay in a relationship when your partner is sleeping around. You say, I'd never stay with a guy who slept around on me. He sleeps around on you. You're still in the relationship. Does it again. You're still in the relationship. And see, it's like it's progressive. You're getting more and more and more shamed and violated. You lie to please others and to make an impression. You start lying. Start covering up. You're lying to yourself, so you start lying to others. You develop addictions to distract yourself from how bad you feel about yourself. You stay in a relationship with an active substance abuser for 2 years without seeking help. That's Timon Shermax, one of his criteria. A UCLA psychiatrist wrote a book, Codependency. Timon Shermax is a psychiatrist. His great work has been to try to help us get codependency in the DMS-3. In the psychiatric official journal, so that we can begin to diagnose it and treat it. But he says, that, you know, one of the characters is you stay in a relationship with an active substance abuser for 2 years without seeking help. You stay in a physically or emotionally abusing relationship without seeking help. You change your routine. You change the structure of your life. You become violent. You become suicidal. And then one of the most common things that happens in the late stages of codependency. You know, the old TA people used to talk about games, first-degree games, second-degree games, third-degree games. Third-degree games are tissue issues. That is, your body tissue gets into it. And you develop ulcers. These are common diseases that go with codependency. You develop heart disease. You develop cancer, arthritis, hypertension. Those are common complications physically. A woman I worked with, severely codependent. They just took 2 feet of her colon out. She just developed cancer. Thank God she's really gotten on an imaging routine, and she's into a vitamin therapy, and she's got the cancer in remission. And because she really started dealing with some of this stuff. But late stages of codependency can be cancer. And again, we're not saying that's the only cause of it. But let's say you have a genetic history of it and you add the codependency to it, it's going to be very hard. Then the next characteristic, the E. So powerless, primary, progressive, and pervasive was the P. Emotional constraint, with or without dramatic outburst. I got that line from Tim and Chermak. Experienced as being numb, having outbursts of feelings, or distorting feelings. See, a lot of us, you say, well, you're psychically numbed out, and the person flies off the handle or goes into hysteria. And we say, well, that person's in touch with their feelings. Wrong. It's almost like you have the dramatic outburst to get it over with, and you're not really in touch with your feelings. Anger, rackets, feeling rackets, like the most common feeling racket for women is to cry when you're angry. The most common feeling racket for men is to get angry when you're scared. Men are taught that real men shouldn't fear, you're a wimp and a weenie. And so they see their dad stomping around. And fear feels powerful. I mean, anger feels powerful. So I tell this thing that happened, you know, this happened one time with Nancy. She met me at the door and said, the air conditioning is out. And I have this tape that says real men are supposed to know how to fix mechanical things. And of course, at that time, 10 years ago, I was not in touch with feelings like I am now. And instead of saying, honey, I'm real scared when you tell me the air conditioning's out. See, mother's voice just went on that says real men are supposed to know how to fix mechanical things. And I don't even know where air conditioner is. So I say, instead of saying, honey, I'm real scared when you tell me that, let's go to a motel and call air temperature, which would be a healthy way to handle it. I said, what did you do to it now? And stomp around the house because, see, that feels powerful. That's a racket. Rage is often a racket, or anger is often a racket. It's a feeling used to cover up another feeling. And so a lot of times if women are angry, they cry. So here's some of the unmanageability behaviors. Your feelings come out in sharp, bombastic bursts and frighten those around you, and you manipulate with that. You don't know what you feel, or you feel nothing. Your fear of anger determines what you say or do. Boy, right, think about that. Think about how you've been controlled by anger in relationships. You somatize your feelings. You're sick a lot. You get sick so you can feel as bad as you feel. You feel shame when you feel anything. You feel only acceptable feelings. See, whatever that is. That means whatever was acceptable in your family. Like the most acceptable feeling in my family was guilt. Anger was not acceptable. Sadness was not acceptable. Fear not acceptable. Joy was not acceptable for very long. About 37 seconds. And then that's enough. Don't get too rambunctious. And they're starving children in Latin America. You never talk or share your feelings. Okay, look at the next one. Noetic disorders. Codependency is characterized by thinking disorders. God, did I hate this one. See, obsessive worrying is a thinking disorder. Good moms are taught, like old natives, that if you beat the drums, you can keep the evil spirits away. So the mother, worry, 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 worry. And then the kid will come home safe. But that's the biggest crock. No, and that never helped any kid get home safe. But it's like, if I worry, then I'll keep the evil spirits away. It's open, it's flexible. All feelings are okay. You can express your feelings. There's forgiveness. Mistakes are learning tools. There's discipline. But the parents are disciplinarians. In dysfunctional families, there's plenty of discipline. You get punished, you get grounded, but the parents are undisciplined disciplinarians. Parents don't do what they say. And so the kids learn exactly. See, remember last night, J.C. Benjamin, the rules for him and the rules for me are not the same. And kids learn what we do, not what we say we do. The family system exists for the individuals, and everybody can leave the family in a healthy family. In an unhealthy family, go to the other side of the page, the individuals exist for the family.
So when I talk to you about your roles today, I want to try to help you get in touch with what was your role in that family. Like one of my roles was hero, star. But my being a hero never did one thing to help my family. So in dysfunctional families, these roles that we get in to try to keep the family together, they don't work. They don't really heal the family. Being my mother's surrogate spouse and her confidant, I didn't help my mother. Those roles don't work. So in dysfunctional families, the roles become rigid. Dad's an alcoholic, so the family needs a husband. So somebody becomes a surrogate spouse. Dad's totally irresponsible, so two of the kids become super responsible to balance the mobile and then play those roles rigidly to try to keep the family together. Mother and daddy have a marriage and they pretend a lot, but they're really angry at each other and they're really lonely. So the kid, their little Farquhar goes to school every day and starts fights and sets fires in the classroom. And when the parents are called in, they can't believe this is their child. This child's perfect at home. What he does is he takes their rage and loneliness, which is unexpressed, the secret, and he goes and acts it out at school. So basically, he acts it out. And he may be doing that ultimately to try to keep their marriage together. So do you begin to see that you get set up in the roles out of the family dysfunction? So you don't choose the roles. The system chooses the roles. The roles are rigid, they're not chosen, they're inflexible, and you exist to keep the family together. That's why it's so hard to get out of dysfunctional families. Because there's something bigger here than any of us. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts. This is a law of social systems. And so in a dysfunctional family, the roles are assigned by the system. There's unhealthy competition. It's punishing or permissive. It's shaming. The feelings are frozen. It's always in terms of right and wrong, perfectionism. It's closed, inflexible, lots of secrets, compulsive. Approval must be earned. You're shamed for mistakes. It's destructive. It's intergenerational. The frozenness will be passed on to the next generation. It's a system in delusion and denial. Now, what I want you to look at here is if you look at the mom and the dad, the circle that represents mom, the circle that represents dad, then I've drawn a line down from each one and a line across, and then here are the children. What I put on this paper, this is something we hand out in our new family life, are all the roles that have been discovered. And you may not identify with any of these, but what I want you to think about as I go through this is, what role were you in your family? Who was the hero in your family? Who was the heroine if your family was dysfunctional? And you may have had a hero and a heroine, but often you'll have a star. There can only be one star. And boy, the star is just everything. Who was the lost child in the family? The lost child may be the first kid that comes along that mother and daddy have because they got pregnant. And basically what a lost child is, the message is, get lost child. It's like we don't really want a kid. Or a lost child could be the fifth child who's an accidental pregnancy. Or you could be the darling in the family and have a little sister that's cuter than you, and you become a lost child. At about three, you lost your role. So there'll always be a part of you until you do some work on this that's a lost child. Now, lost kids tend to be perfect. It's like, get lost child. So what the child will do is go play in their room. They'll be quiet. They won't cause any trouble. And often what you'll get is you'll hear mom or dad talking. They'll say, well, here's my perfect one. She never gives us any trouble. Sometimes lost kids are almost invisible in a group. You just almost don't even see them. They just almost know how to make themselves invisible because really their message is, please let me stay on the planet. I promise you I won't give you any trouble. Somebody said that they're the ones in the system most prone to suicide. Most prone to, because they never get to be bad. They never get to have any bad feelings. They never get to do anything bad. They always have to be perfect. So look at some of those different roles. Hero, little parent. Lots of you were taking care of your little brothers and sisters at a very early age. I used to give my brothers allowance. I was 13 years old. I would give him his allowance every week. Because there wasn't a daddy there. And the system needs a daddy. See, my mother didn't call me in and say, let's see, shall I choose John or Richard to be my emotional spouse? That the system did it. We're talking about the laws of social systems. And these systems are more powerful than individuals. They're also more immature and primitive than individuals. Any therapist in the group that would be willing to stand up so that the rest of you could see that there are people here who do counseling, do therapy, and they're here. And to me, that's one of the best things I could say about somebody is that they're helping other people, but they're also working on themselves. So would any therapist care to stand up, or counselors? Just raise your hand. Okay, stand up. Look around. Go ahead. Come on, Mary. And the rest of you can notice these people, and if you want to talk to one of them at the end, I think it's a very neat thing to see how many counselors and therapists are working on their own lives. And for all of us who do this work, if we're not working on ourselves, it's pretty hard to help others, especially if you're codependent, because you're just going to be enhancing your codependency. Now, the thing that I wanted you to experience is that you probably have been set up in some kind of role, and that or the feeling of that role goes with you all your life. You can be exactly in it 30 years later. The role is one way to help you get to your feelings. By breaking out of the role, you break out of the system. Because remember, the function of the role is to keep the system going. Why do we do the role? Why do you get in the role? Because the system needs this homeostasis. It needs this balance. But the fact is that the dysfunctional roles don't work. My being a hero hasn't saved my brother, sister, my dad, or my mother. My being a caretaker has not worked with any of them. And so the roles don't work. They're dysfunctional roles. And one of the ways to give them up is to begin to realize what feelings did the role demand that you have. What that means is somebody just walked up to you and gave you a script and said, here, play this part in the play. And so when you play this part in the play, you have to have feelings that go with that part, right? And so after 40 years of playing the role, or 20 years of playing the role, or 15 years of playing the role, you don't even know you're playing a role anymore. You think that's what you really feel. And so one of the things about getting in touch with the family system roles is that they are a way to help you get to your feelings. Your feelings about the role and the feelings that you had to give up to have the role. Now, one of the ways out of the role is to express the feelings that you had to give up, to start expressing them. For me to be vulnerable and sad and hurt and need help is a way to stop being a hero all the time. To be willing in a context of my life not to be on stage, not to be the hero, that's a way to start giving up the role. The feeling of the role will stay with you, but you can give up the role, and you can change the role into a healthier way of being.
I don't mind, you know, being a leader. As I deal with my shame, I can handle that more and more. That some of us are called to verbalize things as part of this movement. I know that in AA for years people would say, well, you can say it, you know, you can say those things. That's what I felt, but I've never been able to say it. And I had to grapple with that, but I'm happy. That's paying my dues. As long as I don't start thinking I'm exceptional in some way and that I don't have the problem anymore. That's the danger of getting in the leadership role or the guru role or whatever that is. That's the danger of it. And I don't want, you know, I've got to fight not to let that happen because there's a part of me that likes the ego fanfare and all of that. I don't want to be the hero in my family. I want to be a daddy. I want to love my kids. I don't expect them to, you know, my son's not at all impressed with a lot of my stuff. And I get it that's okay. I'm his dad. I'm not the leader or blah blah or the lecturer. I'm his dad. And it's real important. I'm not a caretaker anymore. I'm a caregiver. And there's context in my life where I'm perfectly willing to give care, but I don't have to. And there are times when I will refuse. I've got 150 people on a waiting list, and I don't worry about it anymore. I used to just grapple with that all the time. I'm moving out of counseling now. It's hard, hard, hard work. And I feel like my energy is better used like this. And, you know, and people want me to continue to counsel. And there's my codependency wants them to like me. And but I can give better care like this. And I can give care and not be a caretaker. Or not be super responsible, not try to be responsible for everybody. Building boundaries, knowing where I end and you begin, not taking on other people's problems when I really need to take care of my own. Those are all the ways that I can work out of this system. And the more I work out of those roles, the more I leave that family. Do you all see that? That the more you give up the role, the more you leave the dysfunction. You get back in touch with your own feelings. You start getting connected with yourself. And then the more you give up those roles and leave that system, the more you're giving up the codependency. And see, that's basically what we've been working on today. Is how do you treat codependency? Well, if I can break out of the system wherein I became codependent, then I am dealing with my codependency. And if codependency is not knowing what I feel, not knowing what I need, not knowing what I want, then stopping taking care of everybody else and starting getting in touch with what I feel, what I need, what I want, that's a way to work out of the codependency. So this is part of the process. Now, it's not all of the process, and there are other ways to do this. There are other ways to do family of origin work. Some of you have done it in therapy. There's other therapeutic approaches to it. I just wanted to give you a sample of a way to do it. And it's a good way. We do this in our family, our Center for Recovering Families. We have a 4.5-day workshop where people work on in 5 hours a day in groups, you work on your family system. And you work on what we call the original pain. Original pain work. See, in some ways, until you go back and express the feelings, you stay in delusion and denial. And the more I can express the feelings, then I don't have to act them out anymore. The more I can express the feelings. And this is also shame reduction work. Because what you're really saying, it's okay for me to feel angry, being set up to be my dad, my mother's surrogate spouse, or my dad's little princess. And that's cost me, it's had life-damaging consequences. It's cost me a great deal, and I have a right to be angry about that. And I have a right to express anger toward that parent. We take bataka sticks, and we put a chair there, and we put the parent over here. We don't hit the parent with bataka sticks, even in symbolism. But we hit the chair and say, I'm angry at you, and express the anger. See, you couldn't do that as little kids. Who could you have talked to? Who would have listened to you? So where did all that energy go? It just went in there. Or those of you who got set up with incest or sexual abuse, you've had to carry that secret for years because you were in this terrible paradox that if you expressed what happened to you, you lost your family. I mean, what a terrible paradox. What a terrible double bind. And incest is all about this. In violent families, you don't dare open your mouth. You're terrified. You get beat up. And then what happens is the victims out of violence often become offenders themselves. Because what victims will do is they'll identify with their violator because their violator was powerful. So victims will literally become offenders because the offender was powerful. And they just simply, it's the only way they can have a reality is identify with that offender. So this is a journey, and we've got to heal that past. Now, another part of the work is the inner child work. And I'm going to do a tiny exercise with you as the last exercise of today of sort of going back and touching that little child. Maybe when I come back, what we can do is the inner child workshop, which is a day and a half type workshop where we go through all the developmental stages. We put people in groups, and you sit in the group, and you hear the kinds of words that you needed to hear as a child, like your infancy needs. You close your eyes, and you have people touch you and say, welcome to the world. I'm glad you're here. Huh? Huh? What'd you say? When are we going to do that? I don't know yet, but we're going to... But you see, those infancy needs, you needed to hear somebody that was happy you were here. And welcome to the world. And you'll have all the time you need to get your needs met. And I want to be close to you. And I want to love you. And I want to touch you. See, some of you already start feeling sad, don't you? The second you hear those words. If you're a lost child, first time I did this, I had 8 of my own clients who were all lost kids in 2 seconds, they were abdominally crying. Because I'm going to tell you, if you didn't hear those words, you've got a hole in your soul. And you grew up without those needs met. And every time you walk in a new situation in your life, those infancy needs come up. See, because those things are recycled. Pam Levin wrote a real powerful book called The Cycles of Power. And she talks about how those needs are recycled through your life. So in my workshop, we go through every developmental stage and have people in groups. I do some of it in hypnotic age regression, and I say the words. We do some of it in groups where you hear the words. At a certain point, you write a letter to your parents, and then you read it to your group. And boy, you may think you know how to dissociate, but when you get in that exercise, I have seen the toughest people go right into the feelings. And of course, there's a tremendous healing because we're all there together and we're all acknowledging that we need help. And it is indeed the most powerful single workshop I've ever been involved in. I've never seen anything like it. And the healing that comes out of it. I was in Dallas 2 days ago. 3 people came up to me and said, changed my life. Because you see, once I can touch that energy again and embrace that child. It's as if I said, here's a child, take them home with you now. And pay some attention to them. It won't take much. You don't have to feed them or clothe them anymore. But just be aware, there's a part of you that's tiny and vulnerable and scared. And that never got to be that way. You had to pretend you weren't. And I keep a picture of a 4-year-old on my desk. People say, is that your son? I say, no, it's me. You know, and it's kind of weird sometimes. And I keep a picture of my wife as a 4-year-old. And when I start getting angry at her and I know all about her life and her childhood, it's very healing to look at that picture
And I get it, you know, that little girl that was kind of abandoned was sent off to summer camps at 5 years old because Mama was bombing around Europe, and who was just literally orphaned, even though her family had some wealth. You know, I grew up poor, thinking, boy, if you have money, you could never suffer. And had terrible prejudice against anybody who had money. But that's not true. People have as much pain with money as without money. But anyway, those are two kinds of things. Then in second level recovery, we do a lot of maintenance work, confronting the inner voices. Robert Firestone has these whole techniques where he has people get the inner voices out and exaggerate them. Like, what are you saying to yourself? And it's just amazing when people get onto this, because a lot of it goes on unconsciously. How you shame yourself, and how you beat yourself, and you put yourself down, and you carry those internal tapes. TA people talk about your parent tapes, your critical parent tapes, the interjected voices. And it's not just from Mom and Dad. It could be from school teachers, or it could be from anybody who criticized you. But see, we will tend to shame ourselves the way we were shamed. So we have to learn how to stop those internal cycles. Then another thing I have people do is write affirmations. And this is a very helpful kind of exercise. Like, in writing this book recently, I've been trying to write a book for 15 years. I've had advances from publishers, and I've never written a book. And so one of the things I did about 2 years ago is I started writing affirmations. I, John, am perfectly capable of writing an adequate book. And you write that 20 times, same sentence, over and over again, ideally twice a day. And then you draw a line down the center column, and over here you put reply. See, a lot of people do affirmations, but they don't do the reply column. And then what you do is you write the affirmation and wait for the first voice that comes to you. And mine will be, this is BS. This isn't going to work. This is too simple. How could this possibly change a lifetime of complexity? These are my voices. And see, what they're doing is they're stoppers. They're going to stop you from being creative. They're going to stop you. Because you see, a lot of times, as tragic as this is, it isn't the conscious part of Mom or Dad, but it's the unconscious, what the TA people call the child in Mama or the child in Daddy, who doesn't want you to succeed. They're too jealous. Even could want you dead. Firestone found over and over again in the voices of people that there was a part of that mother that wanted to get lost. And so you wonder why you have suicidal feelings, or why you have a lifestyle that's really a death style. It's no lifestyle at all. It doesn't bring you life. And so it's real important to boy, when you get that calm, you do this for 3 weeks. Write these affirmations for 3 weeks. And man, I'm telling you, that right-hand column, sometimes you won't believe the stuff you're saying to yourself. Because a lot of it functions unconsciously. So it's another way to deal with the voices in your head that keep you from leaving that system and keep you from getting to your own power. Then I believe in things like assertiveness training and communication training, self-image thinking, all that kind of thing can be really helpful if you've done some of this original pain work. In other words, corrective experiences. But the original pain work is not a corrective experience. It's experiencing what you never experienced, that you're acting out. Does everybody understand that? It's like you never did express these feelings. You had to repress them to survive. So it's not, we're not talking about corrective. We're getting you to go back and do what you never did. See, if you don't work it out, you act it out. That's all you can do with that energy. Or you project it, or you act it in. But it's got to go somewhere, because it's energy. And energy is about molecules and electrons. Emotion is energy.
This is Freudian. This is very Freudian. Freud really discovered that energy is there in our emotional life. Then third level recovery. Now, to me, third level recovery is spiritual awakening. And there's a danger in doing the spiritual work too soon. Because believe me, I was into astral traveling. I was into a monastery meditating on Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross before I could hardly blow my nose. And I was doing all this heavy spiritual discipline, fasting, kneeling 6 hours without moving a muscle, when I was studying to be a priest in the monastery. And all of it, for me, was basically an addiction. It was not because I still hadn't done the original pain work. I hadn't done the family of origin work. And what happens with it is you get into very subtle delusion and denial. It's like, I don't need to do any of this other stuff. I'm in higher consciousness now. And I see some people in higher consciousness that desperately need lower consciousness. You know, yes. I know it. Well, I tell you the way I think it goes, and that's a good point, that I wouldn't discourage somebody from meditating. I mean, again, if you're rigidly codependent, don't rush out of here and say, Bradshaw said I can't do this. Try meditating. See what happens to the quality of your life, to the quality of your relationships. I don't think that everybody has to go the same way by any means, and it may sound like it, but I don't believe that. And I believe there's grace, and I believe there's people that are unique, and I believe there are people that have had grace in their childhood. They had a teacher, they had an uncle, they had an aunt that broke them out of these systems. So that everybody doesn't have to sort of take it. I'm sort of giving you the survey. And that's the problem with it. And there are some spiritual masters who say that you can heal some of this stuff. I don't know about that. I sure tried it that way and it didn't work for me. Now, I'm into daily meditation again. I'm into higher consciousness work. That's more important to me than anything in my life right now. I do dream work. I do some journaling. This is important kind of stuff for me. But I found that it's really going now. And when I was doing it back there at 22, it was almost like an athletic contest I was in. And it was very much competitive, and I was still into a lot of ego with it. And maybe those are some of the things. A lot of the spiritual masters say that if you have unfinished business in the ego, the energy will always draw you back to it. And that's one of the criteria. It's like, are you really clear from the past? And I'll tell you the way that you'll know. You can say unequivocally that your life is perfect. That my daddy was perfect. He was just the kind of daddy I needed in order to be here right now. That my mother was perfect. That the whole system was perfect. That I came into this world, my soul had a journey. My soul had a mission. And that all of that was part of it. But you don't do that until you heal the ego. Because if you're an incest victim and you say you're in the Course of Miracles and you say there's nothing to forgive, nothing really happened to me that was bad, I think that's terribly dangerous. If you go to EST and you do 2 weekends and they come out and they say, did you get it? Your dad's perfect, but you haven't done a lot of the work. That can be damaging. I'm not saying it always is. I'm just saying it can be. I've seen people damaged with it. Well, I don't think it's bad. I think the stuff that's being preached is wonderful. But it's almost like there's one level of consciousness called ego. And there's another level called subconscious. And there's a larger level. It's almost like it's not that you ever get rid of your ego, but the ego becomes an axis. And you've got to be able to cope, and you've got to have enough security, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You got to have enough security in your deficiency needs or your dependency needs that's pretty well taken care of, so that now you can begin to let go. You're not terrified all the time. You're not shame-based. And you can begin to soar. You can begin to let go of ego. You can begin to let go of control. Your whole life's not around control and survival. Because I think to meditate well, you've got to know how to give up control. That's the whole point of focusing on the counting, is to get that ego distracted so you can get to that still, quiet place. And it's in that silence that there's another faculty available to us called enlightenment, intuition. And it's at that moment that you can know God directly. You can know the oneness of the universe directly. So it's not even like the difference between that and ego is like transformation. It's transpersonal. But there's a danger in going there too soon, in the sense that it can be a refuge. And it's very exciting, and it can lend itself to the kind of mood alteration that comes from addiction. Now, anybody who's really done a lot of meditating knows that it isn't all that mood altering. There's a lot of hard work in it. It's like water dripping on a rock. What I wanted was grandiose stuff in the beginning. You know, I wanted to have the experience of God instantly. And, you know, I wanted to turn the faucet on full and now take me into outer space. And, you know, I would get these powerful meditations like my inner guide would tell me to clean up your desk. That isn't what I wanted. What the point is, it's like ego has one point of view and that higher consciousness has another point of view. And from the higher consciousness point of view, your life is perfect. That it all makes sense when you see it in its totality. And Jackie Small says that there's some of us are evolving and some of us are revolving. And I don't know why some of us are evolving and some of us are evolving, but boy, it's clear to me that you can't even be at a thing like this unless there's some energy in you to evolve. And the folks that have no truck with this, as we look at their lives a lot of the time, are revolving. They're in a squirrel cage. It's deja vu. It's the same old thing over and over again. For the 100th time, it's the same fight over and over again. And so to begin to break out of that. So I really endorse the spiritual life and unitive consciousness and cosmic consciousness and moving into that arena of meditation and prayer and quiet and inner consciousness. And I'm making these safeguards. I don't think that you've recovered from codependency until you've had a spiritual awakening. Because it's an inner kingdom, not the outer kingdom. Yes. Well, I think the higher power is there at every stage, in the sense that in the beginning I used my higher power just like I always used God, kind of as a great big bear aspirin. You know, you get me out of this and I'll promise you I'll, you know, and knowing, you know, believing in a higher power in the beginning was really salvation for me, because I didn't trust people, but I could trust something greater than everybody. But for me, that wasn't the major way I came in, because I had all this theology and all this religiosity and all this spiritual discipline. I had to put all that in brackets. And actually, what happened to me is I began to see how powerfully the spiritual was working in people's lives and how seriously they were taking it, because a part of me had so intellectualized it. And I was too young to be reading Teresa of Avila and the unitive way and that kind of stuff at 22 years old. And for me, that's the way it went. You know, for some of you, you may have come a whole different route. And that may be very powerful for you. I'm a Christian theologian. And Jesus Christ makes a lot of sense to me as a model of humanness, as one who forgave and didn't judge, and who told us about his Father, who was unconditionally accepting. That makes sense for me. He said that they may be one as I, Father, in Thee. That it's unitive that He's pointing to. And forgiveness and total acceptance. And how that gets botched up just terrifies me. But on the other hand, I think it's God as you understand her, him, them, whatever. And that's what's important. I resent it greatly that my journey to God was dictated to by Baltimore Catechism 1-12. And that really they stopped me from ever discovering. They were giving me the answers before I even knew the question. Calls the experience of the holy and to come to it on your own. Yes, sir. Well, what I've been describing, that's a great question, that really it is a forgiveness process. When I talk about the anger, see what Kubler-Ross and Eric Lindemann and all these people who have studied grieving and death and dying, because people who know they're dying are grieving for themselves. Kubler-Ross's stages of a dying person are actually the same stages Eric Lindemann found in 1944 when he did all that major study on grief. What he found is that they go through shock, you go through bargaining, you go through denial, you go through anger. So when I'm talking about the anger with the family of origin, I'm talking about part of a grief process. Then you come to hurt and sadness, and finally acceptance and forgiveness, to give as before. But once I'm out of that system, then I can go back and have a relationship with my mom that's a much healthier relationship. Which I do. And I held my dad on his deathbed. I talked to him about dying. I'd done all these death and dying courses. I had no unfinished business with him. And so it's not at all to not forgive that family. But in the process, sometimes you have to get some distance. You have to make a judicious evaluation of how close you want to be. For some of you where you still have very abusive parents, that's where you may have to leave them to their fate. You have to make the decisions about that. But yes, it's very important to get... See, the whole point of that second level work is get that finished. A resentment is a re-feeling of old feelings and just going over and over and over and over. And you're in bondage to the past. When I teach resentment and forgiveness, I say, you're not hurting them with the resentment, you're hurting you. The resentment is like blocked energy. It's like a blood clot that you just keep going over. It's repetition compulsion. And so we want to forgive so we can give as before and heal the past. And that's what this process is. Second level work is a forgiveness process. That's what we're trying to do. Yes, ma'am. Creating a personal myth. Well, what I'd say to you is if that works for you, see, because I think it's all mythology in the sociological sense that we're always creating meanings. You know, the great insight of Est is that they really give us the epistemology. That is, that you can take any event and have a bunch of different meanings for it. In fact, that's the basis of a whole therapeutic technique called reframing. That you can look at the same event in two different ways. And if that offers you a kind of archetypal healing, then I'd go with that. And that is about unconditional love, it is about forgiveness. And if you're growing out of it, see, to me the criterion, love always means spiritual growth.
What spiritual growth means for me is an energy that fuels your lifestyle. That is, it gives you more life through creativity, which is the godly virtue. That is, if you want to be like God, be creative. That I am, God is the creator of heaven and earth. And we've had all this obedient stuff and had nothing about creativity over here. And certainly in this place, with the great artistic stuff that's going on here, that what T.S. Eliot said, that all works of art are religious works, that spiritual works. They touch eternity. What Baudelaire said, it's at once through poetry and art and music that the soul glimpses the splendors that are situated beyond the grave. When an exquisite song or poem, a work of art, brings tears to the eyes or chills down the back, it's not so much an excessive joy, but rather the testimony of an irritated melancholy, a demand of the nerves of a nature exiled in the imperfect, and demanding, even in this life, the revealed paradise. So I think the artwork is a beautiful example of godliness. So lifestyle... Sorry about that outburst, folks. Lifestyle... Where did that come from? Lifestyle is the fuel that gives us more life. A lifestyle means you have more life. You have more life and more creativity and expansion and growth and love. So to me, that's the criteria that I want to look at. And of course, sometimes you can't know. The thing I hate about all this evangelism and Jimmy Baker and Falwell and Oral Roberts is that that's all that extrinsic religion. Gordon Allport at Harvard did all that work on extrinsic religion and how extrinsically religious people were more bigoted, more prejudiced. Where's the inner life? Where's the kingdom that's within? The still, quiet voice. The private life where many are called and few are chosen. Where the narrow gate that very few enter. Because it's private. It's deep. It's profound. It isn't garish. It isn't making a lot of noise. It's that deep nourishment of the spirit. And... It frightens me to see so much of the other. And so much fanfare and so much money being given to it. And, geez, I don't know. Another question. Yes, ma'am. Healthy families being able to fight. Yeah. Well, what I think is that it's so important, whether to send your son to religious school, and what was the other part of the question? Fighting fair. Well, I think giving standards is sort of my own inner standard. If I have standards, then I model that for children. Children are learning what you're doing. And the job of parents is to be models. And the more I model good boundaries, discipline, Scott Peck, it's delaying gratification, telling the truth at any cost, self-responsibility. Boy, if we were modeling that for our kids, see, we don't have to teach them a bunch of rules and regulations. Fighting fair. I'm an unrepeatable... diamond in the rough. You're an unrepeatable diamond in the rough. What happens when these two unrepeatables clash? Which they inevitably will do because we're utterly unique. Now, you're not always going to see it my way. I'm not going to see it your way. How do we fight fairly? And we're going to fight. You can't be intimate if you don't have the capacity for conflict. I have couples come in, 18-year marriage. The woman says, I've never been happy in this marriage. He says, what? Quit telling him that. Tell him you have been happy. Now, this woman's been lying to her husband for 17 years, pretending like she's happy when she's not. The capacity for conflict. Well, stay in the now. Be self-responsible. You're only an authority on what's under your skin. I feel real uncomfortable when you dance five times with Farquhar. It looks to me like you're attracted to him. I feel like I feel scared. I feel rejected. It taps my abandonment issues. Is there something we can do about that? Rather than, who do you think you are dancing with that young boy at your age and as fat as you've gotten? Second one is unfair fighting. First one is, I'm just telling the truth. I'm telling you about what's going on in here. Or I'm confronting you with something that's bothering me. Stay in the now. Argue, you know, fight about what's happening. You know, you're late for dinner. Not, you brought your mother to our condo at Padre Island, 1947. I'll never forget that. Don't fight about details. I'm 50 or 15. I'm 14 minutes late. I just checked my watch. 13 and a half minutes late. See, all of that just gets us. And valuing, if I use I messages, I feel rejected when I see you staring at that guy. And I understand that you can... happen to you in that system, you'll have it happening to you at work, you'll have married somebody, and you'll still be in the role. Because remember, I said relationships are as much about me as they are the person I marry. If I'm a victim, who am I going to look for a spouse? How can I play the role of a victim if I don't find an offender? And victims will walk in a room and look around, they'll find the only offender in the room. And offenders will walk in a room, they'll look around, they'll find the only victim in a room. And it's the darndest thing I've ever seen, how people will find each other in these roles. Because we know the rules, and it feels right. It feels right. See, what we say here is, roles in any family are inevitable. It's appropriate for the father to be in the father role, mother in the mother role, son in the male-child role. There are many roles in functional, healthy families: spouse, housewife, student. Roles in healthy families define behavior, leave the individuals free to have uniqueness, spontaneity, and feelings. In dysfunctional families, roles can be destructive because they are selected to meet the needs of the system rather than the individuals. Roles are mechanisms to maintain balance in the family at the expense of individual uniqueness, spontaneity, and feeling. To become a doctor in my family would have been utterly unique. And I now get it, that my not finishing that dissertation was about my family system. Remember, we do not choose our roles. They're imposed on us through the system's needs. Because these roles deny us our feelings and our uniqueness, we do not know who we are except by the definition we had in the family. So you come to think that this is your identity. The roles listed above are very common, but by no means complete. You may identify with many or few of them. This is not, can you top this? If you relate to two or three, that's fine. Some others may not relate to those. But you see, the real issue around these roles is that you start feeling the role. Like, I have always defined myself as a hero, because that's the role I got into. And then it becomes, you have to be the hero. And one of my sponsors in early recovery, I was going back to Rice to do this doctorate work, and he said, look, I want you to get some C's. And I went, what? Did I hear that correctly? He says, yes, I just want you to get some C's. I just want you to be average. And I thought this guy was nuts. Got me another sponsor, of course. I mean, I was very stubborn in my recovery. But I get it now what he was about. He was trying to get me off this pedestal. Because once you're in that role, you don't have any choices anymore about your life. Now, another one of my roles was caretaker. Another one of my roles was surrogate spouse. Okay? And again, these roles don't work. Because I really didn't take care of my family.
You cannot know how I've tried to get everyone in my family into therapy. I've sent up and, you know, clothes-covered mail. The books come in the mail in plain-covered envelopes. The tapes come in the mail. And I've just busted until I finally get what Renee Fredrickson's saying. You have to have the courage to leave them alone. Because once you're out of that system, all you can do is take care of you. And it's beautiful. Some of you may have your whole families in recovery, and that's beautiful. But a lot of us, that's not going to be what's going to happen. And if you want to have your own life, and you have a right to have your own life, then you have to find out how you got set up. The role is how you got set up. Here's some other roles. Little parent, victim. See, and some people will play victim all their life. Everywhere they go, they're the victim. Because they got set up to be the victim because the system needed a victim. A mom scapegoat. You could be one parent scapegoat. I'm working with a couple right now, a gal right now. Her mother had to get married. She married this gambler, obsessive gambler, who was violent. And she blamed this child all her life. And so she was her mom's scapegoat. Her brother was the family scapegoat. Do you understand the difference in that? You could also have a role that you're your dad's scapegoat. Your dad treated you differently than anyone else in the family. Oldest son will often be dad's scapegoat. The stuff dad doesn't like in himself, he'll start battering the son about. Because often the son will be just like the dad. And the dad doesn't like that stuff in himself, so he'll just beat on the son about it. And say, I'm going to fix this kid. It's what we call the garbage can child. And it's the one that the parent will just beat away at rather than looking at themselves. Dad's star. You may be the athlete that dad never was. So you're playing golf or you're playing baseball to please dad. Or you become a doctor to please dad. Or you become a lawyer. I have a lawyer I work with that throws up about 3 mornings a week going to work. He doesn't want to be a lawyer. He wants to be a veterinarian. Underachiever. If you have a mom and dad who are super achievers, a kid may be underachiever to balance the system. Designated patient, the one that's sent to therapy, who's a service bearer for the family. Addict, surrogate spouse, little princess, lost child, rebel, perfect one, family counselor. That's not on there, but some kids become the family counselor. Some kids become the family mediator. A lot of only kids will become the mediator of their mother and daddy's fights. And get that's your role. So all your life you're running around mediating. And you'll even find a job that'll help you be the mediator. Clown. Little Mary Sunshine. You're always smiling. You're the little oh, she's the sunshine of our family. And see, the family will say these things. This is our little darling. Overachiever. Dad scapegoat. Mom surrogate spouse. Underachiever. The problem. And then if you look at that other page that I gave you, the bad one, label roles, the bad one, the smart one, the pretty one, the sick one, the perfect child, and then all the victim roles of whatever the abuse is, the dysfunctional family roles, little princess, little Miss Sunshine, rebel, lost child, scapegoat, hero, clown, the problem. Role reversal. You can be your mom's caretaker. Mom's so dysfunctional, a little daughter. I have two women I'm working with right now that literally took care of their moms from the time they were 5 years old on. They were cooking at 6. They were preparing the dinner. If you read Carol Burnett's autobiography, and she's taking care of her mom who lives across the street. She took the sister and took her to New York to take care of her. Dad's dad can literally be your father's dad. Surrogate spouse, little parent, dad or mom's confidant. And often parents will make alliances with a child, try to make the child their confidant. And you're always caught in the middle between your mom and your dad. And your mom tries to make you. A lot of times women will be caught up to be mom's confidant, to talk about dad. See, that's a terrible violation of that girl.
But she needs to have her own reality, and she needs to be able to love her dad. And so she's triangulated into Mama's fight. Instead of Mama going to therapy and doing something about her marriage, she enmeshes her child into the marriage. And I just get furious about this. When I see how children are being damaged, it's for children that we're fighting. Children are the hope of the world, and every one of us were tender elves and poetry itself. And how does the world get so crazy by children being violated? And so we've got to become child advocates to fight for the child in us, our own children, and other people's children. Scripted roles. You can become extinct. You become a lawyer because your dad never could. You make money because your dad never did. Extension of mom. You get promiscuous because mom never would own her sexual feelings. I've seen this a lot. Real strict religious family, and the little daughter's acting out like crazy sexually. And the mother's very uptight about sex, and they never mention the word. But you see, it's almost like the more it's absent, the more it's present. Y'all get that one? It's like the more you're denying it, the more you're really focusing on it. So little Guinevere bonds with mother and takes on all mother's unconscious desire to really let it all hang out. And so little Guinevere's laying everything but the Atlantic cable. You become the athlete that your father wasn't, and he's at every game, and he's pushing you, and he's on top of you, and he's pressuring you, and he's living through you vicariously, and you get it that you can't have a life of your own. You have got to do this for your dad, for your poor dad, to take care of him, because he never got any of this. Or you're the doctor that they always wanted, the overachiever, the addict. Do y'all begin to see the damage of these roles? So what I'd like you to do is I would like to take you through a little meditation and just take a few minutes, kind of get comfortable in your chair, and there's grave danger of you going to sleep now at this time of the day. It might be good to stand up and stretch and let the energy... But I'd like to sort of let you get quiet within yourself in a minute and do a meditation with you. And just help you to get focused on that family you came from and what one or two or three of the roles were that you were in. Because the chances are, if you've never really looked at this, you'll find that you're still in those roles to some degree. You're still taking care of everybody. You're still having to be the heroine in the family. You're still scapegoating. You know, scapegoat's the worst role of all, because the scapegoat always thinks they're a bad person. And a lot of times what the scapegoat doesn't get is that they're acting out because of the abuse that's happened to them. And what they always think is that they're being punished because of their acting out. But they're actually acting out because of the way they've been punished. Do you get that one? And it's so important to let that scapegoat know that you're good and you're a good person. And even though you may have done a lot of crazy, so-called bad things, you've been doing that to be loyal to your family. And even the rebel who's rebelling is being loyal to the family because it gives everybody somebody to talk about. That one that's rebelled, and he's not a Baptist anymore, and he's not a Catholic anymore, and he's... And see, the rebel thinks he's rebelling, but he's actually being loyal to the family system. He's actually taking care of the family. Okay. If you just close your eyes, but not too tightly. And like we did this morning, just focus on your breathing for a couple of minutes. Maybe take several real deep breaths. Make a sound as you exhale. Hear that air going out of you.
And then just go to your normal breathing. Become mindful of breathing. And your body already knows that breathing is a symbol. It's a way to begin relaxing, to go back into your centeredness. To relax your eyes and your cheekbones. Just let that relaxation come down through your neck and shoulders. And just wherever you find any tension, just breathe it out. And again, just for now, there's no place you have to go. And there's nothing you have to do. Just imagine now that you're getting ready to step on an elevator. It could be a brand new sophisticated elevator, an old iron brass elevator, or a wooden elevator. Just allow your own unconscious to present you with the imagery for you. And as you step into that elevator, look at the dial and see the number 7. If you don't see it clearly, that's okay. Some people don't visualize internally, and there's nothing wrong with that. Some people are more auditory or kinesthetic. Just feel the elevator now start to move down very, very slowly. So that you just begin to see the tip of the 6, the number 6, and then very slowly see the number 6 emerging. And you feel yourself going down to a place of appropriate relaxation for you, which only you know what is appropriate for you. And you see the whole 6 now, and then you begin to see the 5. It's going down. You can feel it going down. You can feel your muscles letting go. And then you can begin to see the 4. And the 3. And the tip of the 2. The 2. And the 1, the whole 1, and you feel it elevated from all the way down, and the door open, and you see a white marble walkway. Just walk down the walkway, and there are doors on either side, and they have symbols on the door. Just notice the symbols in passing as you walk down this white marble corridor or hallway toward a light, a field of light. And just walk through that field of light into a room and just know that this is your private space. This is like a symbol of your center, this room. And for those of you that do this kind of work, go wherever is the most appropriate place for you, where you know you can get to a quiet, centered place within yourself. And look around the room. See what you see. Make it very beautiful. You can change it if you don't like it. Hear what you hear. put the smells that you like in the room. And the kind of furniture and fabrics you like. Now find a comfortable place to sit in that room. And let yourself, as you sit there, let yourself go back down memory lane, float back in time to some place in your adolescent years, a house you lived in your adolescent years. And just get a sense of that place. You may begin to start feeling a role that you were in, but you don't need to. Just get a sense of what that house was like. Was it a warm, comfortable place? Was it a happy place? Was there a lot of sadness there, a lot of hurt, a lot of rage, a lot of pain? Where was your room? And now just let yourself float back in time earlier than that time. Go back to before you were 10 years old, maybe second grade, third grade, a school you went to. Then the house you went home to in the afternoon. What that house looked like. Who was there? Who was there for you? Your mom, your dad, what kind of relationship did they have? Who was the addict? Who was the controller? The dysfunctioner? Where were your brothers and sisters? Who was the hero or heroine or star in your family? Was there a pretty one, handsome one? Was there a mascot or a funny one or a clown? Somebody that kept the family light and laughing? Was there a scapegoat? Somebody that you all focused on, who was a way not to look at what was really going on. Just let your unconscious really tell you, because you know intuitively, what were your roles? Were you the mascot, or were you the lost child? Were you super responsible? Were you a rebel? Were you an underachiever? Do you have to take care of your mom? Are you your daddy's little princess? Your mom's emotional spouse? Just see if you can focus like on a screen. What were your role? What role or roles? Just focus those roles. And don't try to be too analytical. Just take the ones that immediately come up. Take the ones that come up. One, two, three, or one. It's okay. Just be aware of that role. What were your feelings about that role? Did you like the role? What feelings did you have to have in that role? If you were the hero, you couldn't be scared. If you were the scapegoat, you had to be angry. Or the rebel, you had to be angry. You were the lost child, you had to look good, but you couldn't express how hurt you were. What feelings did you have to give up to be in that role? And just trust your unconscious with whatever you've got. Just come back to your room now. Just let that house disappear. And just be there in your room. And just be aware of those roles. And I'm going to count slowly back now. I'm going to bring those roles with you to your waking consciousness. And you can do some more of this on your own. You feel like you can't quite get it, it's okay. Just bring back what you've got. I count back now from five. Just focus on those roles and just know you're coming back to your waking consciousness. You can come back and do this exercise again. Five, being aware of your roles, the feelings that it demanded, the feelings you had to give up, how you felt about the role itself. Four, three, two, one. Just open your eyes. Just open your eyes. And what I'd like you to do now with your eyes open is just share with somebody close to you. Just spend a few minutes and share with somebody. If that feels intrusive to you, don't do it. But if you can do that, just I want you to take about 5 minutes here, 10 minutes, and share with each other the kind of, what did you get out of that? What do you see? If you didn't get it, that's okay. If you don't feel like sharing, you don't have to make any excuse. You just don't need to do it. But the person closest to you, or a couple of you, can share. Just spend a few minutes and talk, verbalize. Seems like I was the family hero, or I was the family scapegoat. And just talk that over with each other. I like to draw it. This is a drawing from the book I've done on the family. And I talk about stage one, recovery, stage two, uncovery, stage three, discovery. And I really think that you can make those logical distinctions in terms of the progress of becoming a whole, complete person. I don't think that anybody in the process of doing that goes, okay, now I'm going into stage two. But I think that there really is a logical distinction we can say, and that stage one is basically dealing with the outer circles. What I have here are one, two, three, four circles covering up shame. At the core of the problem, codependency equals shame. Shame equals codependency. That shame is this sense of being flawed as a human being. You're hurt and you're lonely. So the first level of cover-up for that are the primary ego defenses. These just happen automatically. Freud said, when reality is intolerable, these defenses come on. Dissociation, repression, denial, idealization, reactive formations, conversion. The second level of defense is the family system. We're going to talk about that this afternoon. The family system and the roles that you get into.
which are all defenses against shame and keep the system in balance. A third level of cover-up, or what I talked about last night and a little bit this morning, perfectionism, control, blame, criticism, contempt, power, all of that are ways, rage, those are ways to cover up the shame. Those are what in 12-step programs are called character defects. Character defects. They are dishonest ways that our interpersonally transfer the shame to someone else. If I'm one up on you and I start criticizing you, then you have the shame now and I don't have to deal my shame. I can mood alter by moralizing, giving advice, making judgments, being in power. The last level of circle is addiction. See, the addiction's covering up the shame. The addiction's the powerful mood alterer. Or the reenactments, where you're acting out the shame. So you go through one destructive relationship after another, where a man is treating you terribly, and you wind up being abandoned every time. You're acting out the shame. Because the feeling that you end with is shame. And all addiction acts out shame too. Here's a shame-based guy who's a sex addict. A woman catches his eye. The ritual begins. A flirtation, being on the make, whatever the ritual is. It ends with them sleeping together at the moment of being loved and adored. All the narcissistic gratification is being replaced. Someone's loving you, kissing you, wanting you, excited about you. Orgasm, you feel one, you feel connected until it's over with. And almost immediately, here comes the remorse. Here comes the shame, here comes the loneliness, and now you got more shame, and more remorse, and more loneliness. And so what does that do? It sets you up for more acting out. See, shame becomes addicted to itself. We become addicted to the shame, and the shame begets the shame. And so in the cycles of addiction, what we call the squirrel cage in the programs, you just keep acting out the shame, which produces more shame, which sets you up to act out more. So we've got to do something about it. Now, putting the cork in the bottle, quit using the drugs, going to Overeaters Anonymous, doing something about your eating problem, putting the cigarettes down, that takes care of the outer level. Working on the character defects takes care of the outer level, second level, and that's what I call first level recovery. Finding a support group, behavior modifying the addictions, working on the character defects. And I tell you, in these 12-step programs, it's hard not to work on the character defects because folks are letting you know. It's good mirroring. Good mirroring. I remember sitting in an AA club one time, and I was into a lot of self-pity. And I said, I think I'll go drink this afternoon. And four guys said, why don't you? And I thought, my God, they should be trying to stop me. They didn't try to stop me. I remember another meeting I was at one time, a guy was talking about committing suicide. Four guys in the group showed him how to hold a gun. Now, I'm not saying that happens in every group, but and that there possibly could be something dangerous about that. But this guy was a grandstander. He used martyrdom, victimization, self-pity, character defect. So those first two levels. Now, the next circle, the family of origin roles. That's what I want to deal with this afternoon. And if you look at the notes I gave you, there's a page, the second to the end. It has family roles on it. Everybody see that page? Now, we use this in our Center for Recovering Families as part of our New Life Family Workshop. This is the one that in its current form was designed by Terry Kellogg. And getting in touch with the family roles. Now, In the literature, it said we were going to talk about doing a genogram, but I can't really do that with you in the time we have allotted. All I would tell you about a genogram is like doing five generations in your family. For one thing, if you're from a dysfunctional family, you'll have a heck of a time knowing anything about it. Right? Okay? I mean, I have had to sneak around and probe and do all kind of stuff to find out about my family. And I've just gotten little bits and pieces of it. One grandfather I never saw one day of my life, so I don't know anything about him really. I didn't know that my grandmother, my father's mother, watched her own mother burn to death at 5 years old until 6 years ago. And my mother just casually mentioned that one day. I didn't know that my grandmother, my mother's mother, was an adult child until 4 years ago. And I got that by really probing questions with my mother. Now, this is crucial stuff to know, folks. To know where, how many generations of alcoholics there are. You know, was Dad an alcoholic? Was his dad an alcoholic? Was one of his brothers an alcoholic? Is there sexual addiction in the family? Now, that's a real new concept. But in doing genograms, you know, five generations, like... There's a book called Genograms and Family Assessment by McGonigal and McAldrick. McAldrick and who's the other one? Monica McGoldrick. Monica McGoldrick. It's called Genograms and Family Assessment. I would wholeheartedly recommend that to you. And it'll show you step by step how to do a family map. How to do a family genogram. And how to pay attention to things like births, deaths, marriages, divorces, life transitions, traumatic events in the family. Daddy lost his company in 1942. Suicides. All of that stuff that gets to be the family secrets. See, shame-based people create shame-based families, and shame-based families are dominated by secrets. Secrets. And we have a slogan in therapy, we say we're as sick as our secrets. Now, I don't mean boundary propriety. There's a difference between a secret and having a good boundary. If one of you comes up to me and starts telling me about your intricate details of your sex life, just, you know, off the cuff. That's a boundary problem. And you probably have met people who have that kind of boundary. Where you meet them on a bus stop and they start telling you all this stuff about them. And it's just that you don't even want to hear it. It's like a violation of you because they don't have any boundary. I'm talking about some of my most intimate aspects of my life with Nancy are our boundary. They're not anyone else's business. That's not a secret. A secret is what you're ashamed to tell somebody about. See, and it's always about shame. Like one of the things on sexual addiction, a lot of times when people are recovering from sexual addiction, the question is, what's healthy sex and what's addicted sex? And so... Patrick Carnes, who's done a lot of work on this, he's written a book called Out of the Shadows. And that's a book on sexual addiction. It used to be called The Sexual Addiction. But when you carry this book around... When I was reading this book, I was propositioned on two airplanes just carrying it around with me. I mean, people are very fascinated in that title. So Patrick changed the second addiction to Out of the Shadows. So the title of it is Out of the Shadows. But he's got this thing he calls the SAFE formula, S-A-F-E. I don't know if I can remember it all, but S is it secretive? Is the sexual behavior so secretive that you won't tell anybody? Or is it something that in an appropriate context you could talk about to your best friend? Or is it so weird that you wouldn't tell anybody about it?
Because really, there isn't any weird sex. There's a lot of shame that people act out in so-called weird behavior. But almost always, that stuff's based on shame. Is it abusive to yourself or someone else? So is it abusive to yourself or someone else? And the F is, are you covering up feelings? That is, do you use orgasm? Do you use the chase? Do you use the excitement of sex so that you don't have to feel other feelings? Your loneliness or your pain or your shame or whatever. And the E, I can't remember what the E is, but that's enough. But just to give you the idea that a lot of sexual addiction is about secrets. So the shame secrets are the things we don't talk about in the family. And remember I said last night, all the secrets get acted out. The children will act out the covert pathology of the family. So you can have a second generation son who's a sex addict and he doesn't know why. When I do the genogram, we find out Daddy wasn't a sex addict, but Terry Kellogg talks about one guy who's talking to the daughter who's married a sex addict. And so he's asking her about her father. And she says, oh, no, Dad didn't have any sexual problems. My dad was very kind. He was a very generous man. He used to have a lot of rent property. And periodically he would put a poor woman up in these apartments. And he would visit them four or five times a week. And he would bring them presents. He even put a prostitute up one time. And he would visit her six or seven times a week. He was a very kind man.
So the therapist is sitting there listening. See, how many of you buy that?
But no question, she'd have passed the lie detector. Delusion and denial. And focusing on the generosity of Daddy's behavior, never suspicioning that there may have been something else. So what does she do? She goes right out and marries her a sex addict. A guy who's womanizing all the time, who's acting out sexually, who treats women as objects. And all of that is part of sexual addiction. So these systems are very powerful, and the secrets in these systems are very powerful. And they get acted out. Now, one of the ways in second level recovery, you've got to know how you got set up. So I'm 10 years and I've got my alcohol behavior modified. I'm not even thinking about alcohol anymore, but I'm still acting out compulsively. I'm still working compulsively. I'm still eating compulsively. I'm still addicted to excitement. See, I haven't dealt with the family of origin stuff. I haven't dealt with the codependency. I haven't dealt with the disease of the disease. I've only dealt with the disease, the outer layer of the circle. Now I've got to start dealing with the family spell, I call it. See, Ronald Lang said everybody is in a post-hypnotic trance induced in early infancy. And in one sense, the unexamined life is not worth living. You've got to come out of the trance. Part of the trance is breaking that family of origin spell. And part of that is the delusion and the denial about the family. So how do we do that? How do we work on that? Well, look at this page on the family roles. See, what we know is that in healthy families, or really look at the last page, the one that has the mom and dad and the kids. We have two circles and they represent mom and dad. And then there's a big black line between them. That's the intimacy vacuum. Because we're going to talk here about a dysfunctional family. Functional families have roles in them. There's a dad who has a role, and there's a mom who has a role, and the kids have a role. But in functional families, the roles are not rigid. Dad may wash the dishes. Mom may do something that's traditionally a male's job. The role of scapegoat will fluctuate. The roles are flexible. One kid will be the scapegoat. Mom may be the scapegoat 1 month.
In dysfunctional families, one person will take that role and it will become rigid. And so one of the ways we differentiate a functional, healthy family from an unhealthy family is that a healthy family, the mobile will be moving gently, but it'll be in motion. It'll be flexible. See, one of the marks of mental health is flexibility. What does that mean? It means you have many choices. One of the marks of mental illness is rigidity. My way or the highway. And that's why controlling people, if they're in the power position, will dysfunction the family. Because it's rigid. Somebody's always in control of everything. And remember, control's a cover-up for shame. So that control madness is one of the major dysfunctioners of family. So if you're wondering why you're compulsive, but your dad was never an alcoholic, and you can't find any addiction in the family, was he a controller? Did he control everything? Could you have your own spontaneity in this family? Could you have your own opinion? See, and so people really begin to get it, that you don't have to have alcoholics to have all this stuff happen in families. And that control is a violation of another person. And we've justified that. We've even justified it biblically at times. That husbands have rights over their wives and the wives have rights over the children. And we take a sociological structure from 2,000 years ago and try to apply it to a world where 100 million people have fought and died for democracy. And act like nothing's changed. And so you take those scriptures and you eternalize them. You make them rigid and inflexible. And you don't focus on love and forgiveness and non-judgment and live and let live. So if you look at this, on one side of the page, there's the idea of a functional family. On the left-hand side of the page, a functional family nurtures basic needs. In a healthy family, everybody gets their needs met. Now, not perfectly, because that ain't possible. But most of the people in the family are getting their basic needs met. You see cheery faces. People are happy when they're getting their needs met. In dysfunctional families, maybe only one person's getting their needs met. Or the controlling person is getting all their needs met by controlling everybody. Mother's imposed her rigid fundamentalist religion on everybody in the family. And is controlling everybody with her religious addiction. And so the other people in the family are not getting their needs met. Dad's enabling it. And the kids all have to give up their reality to please mother. Unconditional acceptance, love is a gift. There are human beings there versus human doings. It's open, it's flexible. All feelings are okay. You can express your feelings. You're late for dinner, not you brought your mother to our condo at Padre Island, 1947. I'll never forget that. Don't fight about details. I'm 50. You're 15. I'm 14 minutes late. I just checked my watch. 13 and a half minutes late. See, all of that, this gets us. And valuing, if I use I messages, I feel rejected when I see you staring at that guy. And I understand that you can be attracted to other people than me. However, when saliva's running down your mouth, it terrifies me. Could you talk to me about that? See, instead of, boy, you adulterer, name-calling, all you get with that is fight and flight. Because it's threatening, it's attacking. Boy, it'll hook your shame in seconds. So fair fighting means that I stay within my own skin, I be clear about what I see and hear, what I interpret, what I feel, what I want, and use I messages in disclosing concrete, specific data. And I've learned to do that. I had no idea how to do any of this 15 years ago. And over the years, I've really learned how to do that. Nancy and I have big fights, and we resolve them. And we don't hurt each other anymore.
We fight like banshees sometimes, but we don't hurt each other. And I think that, to me, I may not be right, but I think that's the journey. That you get to a place where, of course, you're going to have conflict, but you're no longer hurting each other. You're not trying to put each other down. Okay, we're running out of time. Let me ask you to do this. Just close your eyes again. I want to do one last thing. This is a part of the inner child work. And this time, just very quickly, go to that inner place. That inner place where you were, that room where you walked down the marble stairs. And you can do this meditation yourself, and you can take more time with it, or use your own style of meditating. But just go to that place now, that room that's a symbol of your inner self. That's a symbol of your center. And look around the room. Maybe it's changed this time, and that's okay. You can change it every time. It's a place deep within you where you and you alone can go. It's a place of power and integration. And let yourself go back in time to that house you lived in, that little child that you were in touch with a moment ago, maybe even younger than second grade. Just imagine you could see him in the front yard of the house or walking out of the house. Call him over to you. Tell them that you're from their future. And you may not see the child clearly, but that's okay. Just get a sense of that child. I'm from your future. And I know better than anyone in the world what you have been through. Your hurts and pain, your abuse, your abandonment. And if you feel like that you can do this, just a day at a time. Tell them that you've come to get them. That you want to take them with you now. And that they don't have to play that role anymore to survive. They don't have to be a caretaker or a hero. They can just be a little child with you. That you'll put a picture of them in your purse or your wallet. You'll remember them. Maybe for about 5 minutes every day at the same time. Tell them that of all the people they'll ever know in their life, you're the only one they'll never lose or leave. And you may feel a lot of sadness when you say that, and that's okay. Just let that sadness come. Take a little child by the hand. Start walking down the street and look back and see your parents on the steps. Say goodbye to them. You can't cure this codependency until you do. Say goodbye to them. That'll feel real scary. Feel real scary. Start walking along. Maybe you need to pick them up, hold them in your arm, and as you look back, they get more and more distant, farther and farther away. You need to leave that home now to have your own life. And just imagine you could take that little child and put them in your heart. And just do it so that they're inside of you now and you know they're there. And promise yourself tomorrow at noon or 5 o'clock or right before you go to bed at night, when you get up in the morning, you'll just for 5 minutes make contact with that little child. just get in touch with how they feel. And pay attention to them. Their vulnerability. Put that picture of them in your purse or your wallet. And now just go back to your room and just be there. Just be there. Know that child's inside of you. And just open yourself up now to your God or your higher power, to the universe, whatever your way of unity is. Just open yourself up to that now. Let yourself feel one. One with this power, this higher power, this God, Jesus, the universe, that you're a part of everything. Everything's a part of you. And this little child lives in you. And you can love him and nurture him, take him home with you today. And just slowly now, you'll remember this. Just slowly open your eyes. Just slowly, slowly open your eyes. Okay. That's a very powerful kind of work to touch that child in you, as some of you realize doing it. And there's a lot more work we do with that, but you can do that every day. Just touch that part of you. Let yourself touch that part of you. And realize that no matter how old you get, what Walt Disney understood better than anybody is that while there's very little adult in a child, there's an enormous amount of child in every adult. And that's you, way back there when you got waylaid in your roles. You got your codependency set up and finding that inner core. So I hope that that'll work real good for you. And God bless you all. And thanks a lot for having me.